This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
That's good. Let's go on an adventure.
Yeah.
I got lots to show you.
Can I be a Sasquatch too?
You already are. You're my son, JB. My little baby Sas.
La 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 la.
Let's take a dip in the strawberry river.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, to the hard-traveling studios. We'd like to thank you for taking a dip in the strawberry river known as the hard-traveling fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is my colleague, my cohort, my little baby sass, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
Sasquatch is my papa, and he's got to protect me.
Very good. Very good. Good to hear. Well, folks, we've got another rousing edition today of your favorite interactive show and mine, Countdown.
Is it really interactive, though? Because they just kind of listen to it. Like, there's no real interactive portion of it.
Well, it's interactive. It's posthumously interactive.
We should find a way to do like a live version, like kind of like Taboo Tuesday back in the day. Remember that one? Or Cyber Sunday.
Oh yes, Cyber Sunday. Yeah, and it's always had a little bit of an erotic flavor.
Yeah, we'll give like the fans, the dozens of people listening to this podcast, like choices on things, and we'll clearly make like one choice immensely better than the other, just to guide them in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Would you? I can't even think of an example. What would happen, Nick? I just don't know.
I don't
know how to play it off.
I was giving you the scenario, hoping your creative mind would come up with something. And
Would you rather us do a scathing review of Batman and Robin? Would you rather us do a rather lukewarm review of God, I don't know. What the hell's a lukewarm?
What's something we're lukewarm on? Damn it.
What about that? The movie Predators. Have you seen the movie Predators?
Yeah, I like that movie. It's all right.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
Adrian Brody is no Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's for sure.
No. Would you rather review Predators?
Okay.
Or would you rather listen to us make hippo noises for an hour?
Unfortunately, I think people might choose the hippo noises.
They probably might, actually. I shouldn't have thrown that out there. Yeah. This is not an action. This is just an example, ladies and gentlemen. This is not the tried and true example of a best one out of one falls match, a count out match, or a steel cage match.
Yep. We'll get around to that Batman and Robin review at some point, I'm sure. It'll have to happen. And I will make my, very weak defense of it, probably.
Yes. And for those of you that may be listening, there may be some technical difficulties here. I am having some difficulties hearing Nick at the moment. Nick, why don't you sing a little ditty for the folks out there so I can make sure that our connection is where it needs to be.
There once was a man from Venus. He had a rocket ship for a wiener.
Wiener. Anyway, all that being said, folks, it is an episode of Countdown. We are here to count down, as the name implies, our five favorite, least favorite, whatever things. Every month. In this case, we are counting down to continue in our theme in February of Love Month, the heart-traveling fanboys. are here to talk about five Marvel stories we love. That's right, we are counting down our five favorite Marvel stories of all time, And we will be doing that beginning in just a minute. Nick, tell the folks what your methodology was. Did you just go with your favorite stories, or did you try to show some diversity and make sure you only picked one story per character? Or what was your methodology in creating your list?
Well, you have to remember that my Marvel experience is predominantly, you know, based in that of the Ultimate Universe. That was what got me into comics. And as such, by the time I came around as a comics reader, I had kind of missed, you know, the X-Men phenomenon, so to speak. The X-Men, by the time I got into comics, were a convoluted mess of continuity, despite Jeremy Reynolds' proclamations to the contrary, and I just could never get into them. So you won't find any X-Men stories on my list, which is the first thing. The other thing is, you know, I didn't really try to be representative. I just kind of picked the five stories that stuck with me for whatever reason. So as such, my universe or my countdown, my list is pretty heavy in a few specific areas that will make themselves apparent as the list is unveiled.
Yes, and as it comes to my list, I should be upfront in that I'm a little weak on my Marvel in terms of my knowledge and memory of the classic stories, particularly the modern classics, in that I haven't really read Marvel regularly since I was a kid. I mean, when I was from 1989 to about 1996 is my Marvel sweet spot, and then it's a little hit and miss there. I've probably read more Marvel for this show doing the Long Book Hunters than I had in the 10 years combined previously. So my list is going to be...
There's some good stuff in there. I mean,
there is, yeah.
I don't know how much of it you read, but I know the X-Men, that was kind of the golden age of the X-Men.
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah. The
Gauntlet, you know, right. Other things.
The problem I run into with my X-Men fandom is I haven't had a chance to reread a lot of the stories from my youth that I love. So I don't know, like, Fatal Attractions, a lot of people shit on it, but it's one of my, you know, it was the peak of my X-Men fandom. So Wolverine getting his claws ripped out, and Magneto getting mind assaulted by Xavier, and Colossus turning heel, and all kinds of crazy stuff happened. And that's kind of like, that was like the peak of my X-Men fandom. So I can think of no better way to kick off my list than with X-Men Fatal Attractions, which is my fifth favorite Marvel story. Again, we're not saying greatest. I have not read enough Marvel to comprehensively say greatest.
Right.
I'm just saying...
Let me clarify. Stuff like... And I understand that, you know, we're not the Marvel aficionados that many others are. So for me, stuff like Daredevil Born Again, the Frank Miller, Chris Claremont Wolverine run, Kraven's Last Hunt, things like that, I can't put on the list because I haven't read them. And I know I need to read them. I intend on reading them. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
You know, when I created Kraven the Last... Nah, screw it. I'm not going to do my Stan Lee yet. I'm saving that for later. But yes, I was... And spoiler alert, this is a last-minute change to my list because throughout the day, I was waffling on what to put in my number five spot, and I had Hawkeye, My Life as a Weapon, which is the first chapter of the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run, because it was so groundbreaking and so revolutionary and really, truly one of the best comics that I've read in the last 5 or 6 years. Just a great, great comic book that changed the way that people were approaching superhero comics after that. But I got to go with Fatal Attractions because of my childhood love of the X-Men. And this was the story that, for better or worse, was the peak of it. I mean, listen, this was gimmick heaven. This was completely and utterly gimmick-ridden. There were every cover in this massive crossover. We are talking a crossover between X-Men, X-Force, X-Factor, Excalibur, every X-book across an entire line of comics crossed over for months as part of this story, and or at least several weeks. It felt like months. And we had every cover in this story arc, and this is why I loved it as a kid. I'm not going to lie. Every cover had a hologram card on the front of the cover.
Now, how many of those hologram cards featured Justin Credible, Albert, and or X-Pac?
Actually, you had most of them had them. I actually got the rare variant that had Uncle Cracker.
Oh, yes, Uncle Cracker.
And it actually, if you hold it at a certain angle, it shows you Uncle Cracker. And if you hold it at another angle, it shows the text, yo, you dealing with the X-Factor.
And if you hold it at another angle, it shows the text, that just made the list.
Very true, very true. And certainly wonderful hologram cards stuck on the front, which today I can hear all the hipster comic book fans, oh, what a gimmick, oh, how stupid, oh, God, the 90s. Listen, as a kid, as a 9-year-old kid.
What the hell is your hipster comic book voice?
I don't know. That's just what I imagine they sound like. But listen to me. As a 9-year-old kid, holograms are cool. Cards are cool. Covers that don't look like normal comic book covers are cool. So, yes, when I walked into a comic book store with my mom in 1993 and I saw a freaking comic book with a hologram of Wolverine slashing on the front of it or a hologram of Havoc shooting his weird Havoc blasts out, damn right I wanted her to get those comics for me. And I didn't get every part of this crossover either. I only got what I could afford and what I thought looked cool. I wasn't interested in Excalibur. Admittedly, this is bad, but I wasn't interested in Excalibur because it took place in Britain, and I didn't understand why an X-Men team was in Britain. And but I bought X-Men,
truly
I bought X-Factor.
Favorite X-book, I'm sure.
Exactly. And, of course, I bought X-Force, which was, you know, just 90s heaven. And, you know, this story had so many moments that I remember, and that's what it really comes down to is moments that I remember, even if they didn't make any damn sense. My most vivid memory of this story was the issue where Colossus shockingly turned heel and joined Magneto and the Acolytes, which I thought was awesome because I was a wrestling fan. And very rarely do you get heel turns in comics, especially convincing heel turns. And for me, that was a convincing heel turn, at least at the time. I'm sure for people that have been reading Colossus since the 70s, it probably didn't make quite as much sense. But to me at the time, I thought, hey, his sister just died. He's disgruntled with the X-Men's cause, so it makes sense why he would join Magneto. But in that issue, as I recall, or perhaps the issue where he returns to the X-Men after having turned heel, there's this incredible battle with Bishop and Magneto, or Magneto's attacking the X-Men, and he unleashes this giant energy blast, electromagnetic pulse or whatever, and Bishop has been absorbing this for the entire issue. And much like Goku unleashing the spirit bomb, Bishop unleashes the full force of his power on Magneto with this mega blast, only to find out that it actually doesn't work, and Magneto is unaffected by his mega blast, and it's just it was awesome. I remember that panel being the first splash page, maybe the second splash page after Death of Superman, that really vividly sticks in my childhood mind from a comic book. So love the imagery throughout this. I'm not even sure who was on art for it, probably the Kuberts. But it was wonderful. And of course it culminates with Magneto ripping the adamantium out of Wolverine, which felt like the last big talked about at school comic book moment of the 90s. Like it felt like that was the last big comic book moment that all the kids at school were buzzing about, because everybody read that issue and came in the next day and were talking about it and said, oh my God, did you see Wolverine get the adamantium ripped out of him and all that stuff, which is crazy probably to hear nowadays, but that's how big the X-Men were in 1993. So, and then of course it culminates with the mind wipe as Xavier goes nuts on Magneto. And to me, it was it's the pinnacle of just 90s craziness.
Was that planting the seed that would eventually grow into the crop that was Onslaught?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. Yep. It started the, what was it, 2-3 year voyage towards Onslaught. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, excellent in my opinion. For again, if I reread it today, it'll probably be like He-Man cartoons, where when I watch it today. It doesn't hold up at all. But in my childhood memory, that's all I have to go on this, and I have to go with Fatal Attractions at 5.
Well said, sir. You know, again, the 90s X-Men is a bit of a dark spot in my fandom knowledge, so I can't really comment too much, but nothing wrong with having some stories you loved as a kid on there. For me, I'm going to go here at number five with, and you're going to have to forgive me, Greg, because I was very tempted in the creation of this list to do a couple of cop-outs, and I, for the most part, avoided them. But here's one that you're probably going to accuse me of a cop-out, because I am counting as one story in Ultimates Volumes 1 and 2.
Oh, come on!
That's what I'm doing.
Oh, come on!
I am counting Mark Miller, Brian Hitch, the Ultimates Volumes 1 and 2, and my argument here is because it kind of, you have to read them both to get the full narrative through line of the main reason this makes my list, which is the Thor character arc. You can't really get the entire Thor story, as I like to imagine it, from the Ultimate Universe without having them both together. And so, this run on the Ultimates, you know, it, I gotta be honest, I've gone back in the years since and read a lot of mainstream Marvel Avengers books, a lot of them. I've read, you know, the Korvac Saga, I've read Disassembled, I've read Civil War, I've read all the modern stories, really, and a lot of the, you know, the classic 60s, 70s, and 80s stories. And I gotta be honest, I still think this is probably my favorite Avengers story that I've ever read. It felt like it contemporized the Avengers in a way that is absolutely of its time. There's no debating that. We've talked about that previously in our reviews of the two volumes when we've done them. But, you know, it also was heavily influential in terms of, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe took a lot of cues from that first volume of the Ultimates, for better or for worse. Now, granted, it knew, you know, which things to pull and which things to avoid. Like, it largely avoided the somewhat unique take on Captain America while taking some cues from, you know, some of the other takes on various characters there in that universe. But Miller just had a great way of writing the character interactions, snappy dialogue between the team members, the bickering that would become kind of the hallmark of the Avengers film. And then Brian Hitch's art, granted, he goes to the alien invasion well once again in the Ultimates Volume 1, but I can't really knock him too much for it, because it was damn beautiful to look at. And there are just great moments throughout it. Their version of Steve falling into the ice is fantastic, because it opens the very first issue of the Ultimates with, you know, a letter from Steve to his soon-to-be long-lost love, Gail, explaining that he's sorry that he won't be coming home and all this other stuff. Of course, the Thor stuff. The Thor stuff they do in Volume 2 with really ratcheting up the is he crazy or is he who he says he is, it really kind of gives you a look of a god struggling with mental illness, and it's just a great take on that character. Their version of Tony Stark was easily the most charismatic and intriguing Tony Stark put on the page to that point, Iron Man 1, so to speak.
Yeah.
And there are just some great knockdown, drag out action scenes. The big climactic scenes of each volume, of course, are fantastic, and then also the fight scene between Captain America and Giant Man that closed the first little initial six-issue story arc was fantastic as well. So, you know, not the last time you'll see the Ultimate Universe on my list, to be sure, and yes, a bit of a cop-out, but I'm going with Ultimates Volumes 1 through 2.
All right. No issues for me with Ultimates Volume 1. I thought was really, really good. I wasn't huge on Ultimates 2, but Ultimate Thor is one of the best takes on Thor that I've seen. So definitely a big fan of that take. But I have to go back to this. I was going to save this argument potentially for another time. But Nick, would you count The Empire Strikes Back as a standalone movie, or would you count it as part of a trilogy and use that as one entry?
I would count it as part of a trilogy.
Oh, my.
It's a middle chapter, Greg.
But it's... That's the equivalent of saying that The Hobbit isn't a standalone book because it ties into The Lord of the Rings.
Completely different. Ties in and is a direct, you know, sequel to or direct part of the story is a little bit different.
The Lord of the Rings
a standalone story?
Is The Lord of the Rings a continuation of the story established in The Hobbit?
Loosely, yes.
Well, then it's one story, right?
It could be. The Middle-earth Saga.
Oh,
Peter Jackson's 27-hour-long opus.
My God, can you imagine?
Oh, David Sunday should sit down and watch them all back-to-back.
Just one would do, I think, at this point. just watch one.
I own the extended edition of all those movies, and I can't imagine. I have not sat down and watched it. I probably never will. The extended version of the first Hobbit movie sounds to me like one of the most boring experiences anybody
I've ever still seen. Not seen any of the Hobbit movies,
oh
by the way.
Oh, my God, dude. Like, I know the Kevin Smith joke about them walking. It was funny. I didn't feel like it was accurate as it pertained to Lord of the Rings. That first Hobbit movie, dude, that's literally all they do is walk. It's just a bunch of little people walking across the screen for like 3.5 hours.
And just too ugly.
Occasionally they sing songs.
Just two ugly people looking at each other.
We're digressing immensely.
That's true. That's true. I'll watch the Hobbit films at some point.
Now, in my defense, I said I was tempted to do that in other places, and I'll talk about that with my next entry. Once you hear what I initially planned on doing, I think you'll find it somewhat comical. But go ahead.
Oh, my. Yes. All right. At number 4, I have a book that I only read just a few short months ago. For the first time ever, I have The Punisher, Welcome Back, Frank.
Nice.
Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon, which is not Welcome Home, Frank Castle, as my colleague once called it. This is a book that I did not read until, when did we do that, Nick? November, I believe, shortly after the death of Steve Dillon.
Yeah, it was the month after the death of Steve Dillon, so
yep.
That sounds right.
I believe that would have been November, and that was the first time I had ever read this story. I'd heard about it for years, and, you know, is this the best Punisher story ever written? I can't say. Is it the best Punisher story I've read? Yes. Is it one of the best Marvel stories I've read? I have to say yes, because it captures the attitude and the feel of one of my 5 favorite comic book series, period, which is Preacher.
Right.
And the fact that that look and that feel and that attitude translated over to a mainstream character, granted a violent mainstream character, but a mainstream character like the Punisher, really impressed me and won me over. And it's the hardest I've laughed at a comic book in a long time. And there's something to be said for that. The fact that you can have a serious, gritty comic book that just makes you laugh the whole way through, which is what Preacher was. And I think that this is a version of Frank Castle that makes sense to me, that's single-minded, completely in step with the character that had been established, but it puts him in an environment that makes him just immensely entertaining and takes advantage of the outlandishness of the Punisher concept. Because it's easy sometimes when you're doing a character like the Punisher to make your comic boring because, you know, the character is monotonous, the character is single-minded, the character's not cracking jokes, the character's not going through existential crises. You know, I don't want to say he's not well adjusted at all, but he's emotionally stable in that he is consistent in his anger towards the criminal world. He doesn't really go through periods of depression necessarily. Well, in this book, you get a Punisher that is given supporting characters and villains to play off of as the straight man that makes him a funny character, that makes him an entertaining character. And that makes you want to follow his journey beat by beat by beat, whether it's his comical battle with the Russian, whether it's, you know, Ma Nucci and her goons and her star-like ultimate fate.
Mr. Bumpo.
Mr. Bumpo getting stuck in the door.
And
winning.
Andy in a later fight.
Yes,
with the
that's right. And using the power of his massive weight to his advantage. Just a tremendous story, tremendous book, tremendous artwork from Steve Dillon, and that classic Garth Ennis wit that anyone who is a fan of Preacher, Hitman, etc., knows and loves so good, as we like to say here on the HTF show. So, number 4 for me, Punisher, Welcome Back, Frank.
Excellent. You know, I enjoyed the story very much as well. Gotta be honest, when I was making my list, I forgot to even consider it, but in hindsight, probably should have at least given it, you know, given it a second look when it came to time to make this list. But moving on to my number 4. Now, Greg, I don't think there's any secret that you and I both knew that my list was going to have a heavy influence of Ultimate Spider-Man on it. You know, that that was not in question.
I think I know where this is going, Nick.
Up until today, I had fully intended on ranking as my number one spot Ultimate Spider-Man 1 through 150 as one.
Oh, my
standout.
God.
I had intended on making that argument.
Oh.
On second thought, after looking at it today, I decided not to do that. And to be honest, I easily could have filled out a top five with just Ultimate Spider-Man stories. But I decided to limit myself somewhat. Ultimate Spider-Man will make another appearance on my list in the future. But at my number four spot, I'm going to go with Ultimate Spider-Man Death of a Goblin. This took place in issues 112 through 117. Notably, it featured the first full story arc for Stuart Immonen as artist after taking over for Mark Bagley after they co-drew issue 111 together. And then Eminem took over full title, you know, the full artistic responsibilities with 112. But basically, I love this story because throughout Ultimate Spider-Man, the entire run, there's always whatever little 5 to 6 issue story is going on in the present, but you can always tell they're planting seeds for bigger things to pay off down the road. And this is probably one of my favorite stories where they're paying stuff off that they've been building to for, you know, 3-4 years at that point. Pretty much since issue 1, they had been building to some sort of giant confrontation between Harry Osborn and Norman Osborn. You know, a resolution of their relationship, a resolution of, you know, how their relationship had affected Peter and how each one of them related to Peter individually. And so in this story, you kind of get this final big emotional showdown between these two characters with Harry Osborn and his role of the ultimate version of the Hobgoblin, and of course Norman Osborn as the Green Goblin. And you kind of get these two characters in a big knockdown, drag-out fight, and Peter is there the entire time just trying to prevent, you know, Harry from getting hurt, essentially, and the way the story ends with the death of Ultimate Harry Osborn is one of the biggest gut punches in the entire book, the entire series to that point, because it was a fate that Peter had fought so hard, you know, for over 100 issues at that point to prevent Harry from meeting. And so it was just such a great bit of writing by Bendis, who often gets, you know, he often gets knocked unfairly for being, you know, all quip and no real substance, but here he really leaned into the emotional stakes for Peter. Combined with that, this also featured another little resolution in the Peter and Kitty Pryde dynamic. To that point in the story, the two had been in a romantic relationship, had ended their romantic relationship, and basically Kitty had it out for Peter at that point and was accusing him of essentially ruining her life. And so this story also featured her being able to finally work through that and the two characters to find a common ground again and show that even if, you know, their relationship isn't what Kitty wanted it to be, they were always going to be there for each other when the tough really got going. So for all those reasons, for the Stuart Immonen art and just the emotional impact of this story, I got to say Ultimate Spider-Man Death of a Goblin finds a spot on my list and is, you know, my second favorite Ultimate Spider-Man story of the entire run.
I have a couple quick questions for you, having never read it myself.
Yes.
You mentioned that Harry is the ultimate Hobgoblin.
Yes, the Hobgoblin.
Norman is the ultimate Green Goblin, right?
Yes. Yes.
At any point, does the ultimate Demogoblin show up?
Thankfully, no. Not that I am aware of. Now, granted, there's about a 9-issue run in the middle of the initial Miles Morales series that I've never actually read, because I wasn't buying comics at the time. I've been intending on going back and reading. Mm-hmm. So unless the Demogoblin pops up in the Miles Morales title, to my knowledge, there has not been a Demogoblin in the Ultimate.
Gotcha. Game. And would he be related to Goblin Goblin?
Yes, of course. Now there's Jack Goblin and, you know,
Michael Goblin.
And Michael Goblin. And then, of course, there is Goblin Goblin. And strangely enough, you know, while Harry and Norman were having this big drag-out fight, there was the ultimate Bernard sitting there with an oxygen tank and an old Navy hat watching it all go on. So that was good as well.
Boy, we've just created a whole nother list, I feel like.
Yes, I feel like we have. No other person will get that, but that's okay.
My other question for you was, at any point during these 100 issues, did either of the Osbournes develop basketball hair?
There was a distinct lack of basketball hair in the Ultimate Universe.
Interesting.
They kind of always had the, what I refer to as like the mid-2000s frat boy hair. You know, that kind of like tall.
The James
hair.
Franco?
Kind of like the James Franco hair, but a little less wavy. Like, just kind of tall and swoop back, you know, that whole deal. And Norman always kind of had like this chic, kind of like this shining buzz cut thing going on. But no basketball hair, to answer your question.
Cheeky baby!
And Peter always had this weird bowl cut for some reason, so, you know, you do what you can.
Oh, boy. That's good. I knew you'd have a couple of Ultimate Spider-Man stories on the list there.
I didn't list the entire 100.
No, I was going to say, I'm glad. I'm very glad that you actually picked out individual stories for that. That's good. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, at number 3, I am going with another modern Marvel story. What is to this point in my life, and again, I have not read all of the stories involving this character, or even that many, but easily the best Thor story I have ever read, Thor the God Butcher by Jason Aaron and Esad Ribic. I don't want to steal any of Nick's thunder in talking about Thor, but this was really a revelation to me. This was truly my breakthrough exposure to Jason Aaron. I had read much of his work before and never really cared for his takes on Wolverine or the Hulk and things like that, but talk about a writer just getting a character. Like, from the minute he took over this, literally, from Thor God of Thunder, issue number 1, which is the first part of the God Butcher story, he immerses the reader in the world of Thor, in this Norse mythology, in Asgard, in the history and the future of this incredible character, Thor, and the artwork from Esad Ribic. Good gravy. What can I say about it? I mean, this guy... how was it that I once put it, Nick, in one of our shows or maybe in a column? It was like the Led Zeppelin song, Immigrant Song, came to life on the comic book page. Like, literally, I don't know how you can read this book and not listen to Zeppelin, because as a diehard Zeppelin fan, every page that I would turn would remind me of a different song or take me back to just Immigrant Song, honestly. But No Quarter is another good song to listen to while reading this story. It's, as we've talked about before, and as anyone who has listened to me talk about the death of Superman and about Nightfall knows, I am a sucker for a story where the hero gets beat by the bad guy, basically. Not long term, but temporarily gets beaten by the bad guy. And this is probably the best example of that I've seen from Marvel, other than another book that's going to show up on my list. And this is a situation where Thor does not win. I mean, really, by the end of this story, this particular story, the God Butcher, Gore has the advantage, and Thor is you know, left pondering whether he's wrong about everything that he's ever believed. And the fact that Jason Aaron and Esad Ribic are able to show us 3 different versions of the same character, Thor, and 3 different versions of the same villain, Gore, is just mind-boggling when you think about it. But when you read it, it's so seamless. It does not confuse the reader. It does not lose the reader. At no point are you sitting there wondering, well, wait a minute. If Darkseid is here as Boss Darkseid, why can he ever be killed if he was just killed a few issues ago? And what is the Omega Sanction versus the Omega Beam? But anyway, none of that here. It's seamless. The transitions are seamless. It uses flashback and flash forward storytelling in a way not unlike the first couple seasons of Arrow, in that they tie into the theme of the individual chapter and also the larger story as a whole. I can't say enough about this. This is a 10 out of 10 story, in my opinion.
I completely agree, and I will have a little bit more to say about it in just a few minutes. But, you know, from one Thor story to another, and I think, you know, if any true hardcore Marvel fan were taking a look at probably either of our respective lists, Greg, they would probably have a lot of issues with these lists. But I think this choice is one that most would agree is certainly worthy of being called one of the five greatest Marvel stories of all time. And that is the classic Thor the Surtur Saga by Walt Simonson from back in, oh man, I want to say late 70s / early 80s. I can't really remember the time frame, but this played out officially over issues 340 to 353. And at the point when this came along, Simonson had been on the book for about 2 years. And very early in his run, he had started using this technique of ending a lot of his stories with this this ominous image of this giant fire demon pounding on this sword. And you saw the panel, you know, the sound effects, the onomatopoeia, if you will, on the page that said, doom, doom, doom. It was an effect that, if I recall correctly, he and his wife would later reuse on Death of Superman, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
In the build to Death of Superman.
Yep, that's right. Event. Yep.
But so you had this ominous tease, this build going on for almost for a little over 2 years, and eventually it all played out in the Surtur Saga. And basically here you get to see kind of the first real quality representation, I should say, of the idea of Ragnarok being played out on the page and how the Asgardians are seeking to prevent that. And just iconic images throughout this entire story. You find, after years of being at odds, you find Thor and Loki kind of united in a common goal because Surtur is going to end all existence. And so it has the fantastic image in the final issue of Thor and Loki and Odin all standing together and preparing to go into battle against Surtur. And, of course, Odin shouts out for Asgard, Thor shouts for Midgard, and Loki shouts for myself. And they all, descend upon Surtur in this great, in this fantastic battle. And one of the major themes that had been played out, not through Simonson's run, but throughout, kind of the entirety of the Thor character at that point, was the fact that Odin, as an all-father to that point, had been rather impetuous and rather arrogant and didn't really seem overly concerned about his son's happiness or well-being. He wanted things to be the way he wanted to be them, and damn everybody else. Very Vince McMahon-esque in that regard. And so, this story, the finale...
Wow! Now you're really making me re-examine the Thor mythos with Vince as Odin, Triple H as Loki, and Shane as Thor.
There you go. There you go. But, and so finally, in the battle with Surtur, Odin actually sacrifices himself to stop the fire demon in a true selfless act. And that kind of, spins off into this whole other run of stories by Simonson where, Odin is presumed dead. Of course, it's eventually revealed that he isn't dead. But, and that sets up a whole other bit of stories where it's essentially a civil war for the throne between Loki and Thor, and each making their case as to who should rule Asgard. But, this just... for the build, the way it was built to, the amazing art and a depiction of Surtur that they've used the character in the decades since, but nobody has ever been able to use the character with the expertise that Simonson did. And I am just hoping for one time in my life before I die to see a Walt Simonson-esque version of Surtur up on the big screen, because it's still the iconic version of what could be, in my opinion, the greatest physically threatening Thor villain of them all.
Yeah, I remember both of us were kind of expecting Surtur to be the villain in Thor Ragnarok.
I have read some things online that may still be the case, but I don't know.
Well, let's not get our hopes up, but that would be cool.
Not.
And I've never had a chance to read the Walt Simonson Thor run, but I've heard so many great things from so many different people. I have no doubts I would love it. Certainly groundbreaking and it truly set the stage for everything that came after. Yeah,
it set the template for what Thor was going to be for the next 25 years. And I would argue, from the time Simonson left, pretty much up until J. Michael Straczynski came on in 2008, pretty much everybody was just doing their riff on the Walt Simonson Thor, which is a great, don't get me wrong, it's a great approach to the character, but it was so iconic and so defining that every writer who wrote the character for the better part of 20 years after, or better part of 30 years after that, just kind of toiled in the shadow of Walt Simonson. And it wasn't until JMS that somebody tried something truly outside the box and different with the character.
Yeah, kind of like the writers who all had to follow Frank Miller on Daredevil and Frank Miller on Batman.
Right.
You know, a lot of it was, how do you follow somebody that's made that big of an impact? Well, we talked about it as well with Geoff Johns. Even now, we're seeing a great Robert Venditti run of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps that has kind of done his version of the Sinestro Corps War, his version of the War of Light, things like that, which is cool, which is great, but it speaks to how innovative that initial work was, and that's what Walt Simonson did with the Thor mythos throughout the 1980s.
And I will say here, you know, a lot of times when you hear about these classic stories, they get built up in your head, whether it's to stay in the Marvel, like, for example, the Korvac Saga, which is always pointed to as one of the great Avengers stories of all time, or something like the, the cosmic one, Greg, help me, the Shi'ar, the Kree-Skrull War.
Kree-Skrull War, yeah.
The Kree-Skrull War, both of those stories I've read, and I gotta be honest, those two stories, while they're good stories, kind of didn't live up to the years of hype that have been put behind them. This Simonson run on Thor absolutely lives up to it, because you can, like I said, you can see the fingerprints of what Simonson did all over pretty much every modern Thor story, and it's still, you know, it still is so influential. I would argue probably more influential to a particular character than possibly any run by any creator ever. I mean, it's that defining.
Well, speaking of defining and defining an era, we talked last week about the Sinestro Corps War and how it is. Actually 2 weeks ago, about the Sinestro Corps War and how it is the definitive Green Lantern story, the definitive galactic DC story in many ways. Well, I want to go to, for my number two pick, with what I consider the definitive galactic Marvel story, the definitive 1990s Marvel Comics story, and the definitive the bad guy really puts it to the hero's story, and that is the Infinity Gauntlet, which was by Jim Starlin and a host of artists back in the day. George Perez, I believe, was one of the guys involved in this. I could be mistaken on that, but the Infinity Gauntlet was the culmination of a years-long cosmic saga that Jim Starlin had been writing since the 1970s. This came out in 1991, July to December 91, and it was penciled by George Perez and Ron Lim, and all-star creative lineup with Starlin there. But Starlin had been working on these characters in this side of the Marvel universe, which is something distinct about Marvel and a little bit different from DC, in that Marvel has always kept its galactic, cosmic side pretty much separate in many ways from the rest of its publishing initiatives.
I think the rare crossover there is probably the Shi'ar Empire and how influential
yes.
they were in the X-Men, but that's kind of really the only point where the two really meet a whole lot. Normally, Cosmic Marvel is off over here doing Cosmic Marvel things, and, you know, more terrestrial, for lack of a better term, Marvel is sitting over here doing its own separate set of things.
Right, and in many ways you can trace that back to the work of Jim Starlin. Throughout the 70s, whether it was Thanos' appearances in Iron Man and Avenger stories and stuff like that, on through the 80s where he establishes the backstory of Thanos and the backstory of the Infinity Stones, the Infinity Gems, and this was the culmination of that, in which Thanos, the ultimate representation of devastation and destruction, and again, that single-minded evil entity of the Marvel Universe, much the Marvel equivalent of Darkseid, gets his hands on the ultimate weapon. And unlike most comic book weapons that are described as the ultimate weapon, the Infinity Gauntlet was actually the ultimate weapon.
Yes.
It was not this incredibly powerful device that has this one glaring weakness in it that the heroes exploit. No, there was no weakness.
There was no ultimate nullifier for the
for
the Infinity Gauntlet.
Nor were there any propeller arms of freedom that could nullify the device. It was a weapon that gave Thanos the power of an omnipotent godlike figure. Period, and no exaggeration there. He literally reshapes the universe in his image. He defeats every hero. He kills hundreds of them with a wave of his hand. He wipes them out. And ultimately, he's undone by his own emotions because he still can't win the affection of the one thing that he wants, which is death. He worships death, and Lady Death will not give him her affection. And but the story around it is just amazing. The pacing of it, oh my God, the artwork. I'm sure Todd and Tim could talk much more extensively about the beauty of this artwork and much more about the details of the story, which I haven't read in a long time. But the artwork, again, I remember it in my mind as being these incredible battle scenes, this image of like Wolverine with like a tree stuck through him or something, and of course that iconic moment when Captain America picks up Mjolnir, just a great moment, and it's filled with great moments, and it's a great story that shows that you can write a story about these inspirational heroes where they are more inspirational in defeat than they are in victory, and that's what I think a lot of people that are loud voices in the comic book community sometimes miss, is that what makes someone inspirational isn't that they win all the time. What makes someone inspirational is how they react to losing. And that is true in sports, that is true in life, that is true in comics. And so seeing how Captain America, in the face of certain death, picks up that hammer and goes towards Thanos, knowing what's going to happen, knowing that it's certain death, and he goes and he faces it anyway, and that is inspirational. That is superhero comics. That is Jack Kirby and Joe Simon and Stan Lee, and this story in many ways feels like the culmination of the 30 years of the Marvel Universe that preceded it. So, highest recommendation for the Infinity Gauntlet.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that cover to even Infinity Gauntlet number one is still one of the most iconic covers in the history of comics. And
yeah,
you know, a while back we did our top five Marvel event stories with Tim Capel, and we all had this on the list, and I actually took the time to revisit it then, and I'm telling you, man, for a 90s comic, because, you know, the phrase of its time is something we use a lot on this show, and I think certainly there is an element of that to the Infinity Gauntlet, but I would argue it holds up a hell of a lot better than most of the 90s stories you can go back and read these days.
Yeah, and your mentioning of that cover is a great actual point that we may need to talk to at the end of this countdown, of the power of a cover, of an iconic cover. So let's go back to that at the end of this countdown.
Sounds good. Well, moving on to a story, or should I say part of a story, that Greg has already mentioned earlier. My number two, much to Greg's chagrin, I am going with Thor, God of Thunder, and yes, I'm counting God Butcher and God Bomb is one story, 1 through 11. Consecutive issues, sir. No break in between. And I believe they've actually been collected together at some point. So there you go. That's my argument. I'm sticking to it. This gives you the entire gore, the God Butcher narrative, you know, narrative through point from inception to its end. And it is a heartbreaking story. Greg mentioned from the get-go about, you know, how emotionally devastating that opening few issues is, with gore really getting inside Thor's head and making him question, you know, his entire being, essentially. And eventually, over the course of these 11 issues, we also learn about what made Gore come to be. And it's so such a beautiful case of simplistic yet outstanding storytelling. The classic story of somebody becoming the thing they hate most in the world and having to realize how far they've fallen. But along the way, you get outstanding, I mean, just moments of action, moments of hilarity. The interactions between in the back half in God Bomb between old King Thor and young Thor are among my favorite interactions in all of comics. Also, the introduction of Thor's three granddaughters who mistakenly hit on their younger grandfather at some point is also pretty hilarious. This book is just filled with moments. And the rare thing that so few writers in comics these days get to do is Jason Aaron, in the course of 11 issues, is able to add major elements to the Thor mythos in a way that no writer had in many years. I mean, he introduces one of the greatest Thor villains of all time in Gore the God Butcher. He adds the characters of Thor's three granddaughters. He adds the concept of Omnipotent City and the Council of the Gods and all that. The librarian character, who is hilarious in this one. And you just get, like, so many great moments added throughout. And then finally, that climactic, heartbreaking moment when Gore is ultimately undone by his own son, who kills him because he's been trained and brainwashed to hate all gods, and he realizes that Gore, his father, has essentially become a god. And then Gore has to watch as everything he has created slips away in the moment of his death, and it is amazing. And as you said, Asad Rivich draws the entire thing. For my money, and I say this fully knowing that it's blasphemous in a lot of circles, for me, Jason Aaron is the greatest Thor writer of all time, and Asad Rivich is the greatest Thor artist of all time. And I'll go to my grave saying that unless somebody comes along and proves me wrong.
Yeah, what if Andrea Sorrentino got a crack at him?
Oh, my God. Don't tease me.
No, in all honesty, all joking aside, I do think it's a cop-out on your end, but I cannot disagree with anything you said about the story. It is wonderful. It is intriguing. It's satisfying in a way that comics sometimes aren't. It's just perfection. Like it is a, like I said earlier, it's a 10 out of 10 story, and I can't think of a better representation of Thor. And it's hard to really think of a better representation of any Marvel character in my mind, except perhaps my number one entry. And my number one entry, as all of our number one entries are, is a personal choice. It comes down to my personal biases, character preferences, things like that. My favorite Marvel character is and has been since I read my first Marvel comics, I think, has been Wolverine. And the best Wolverine story of all time, still to this day, is the very first Wolverine miniseries, Wolverine Volume 1, and that is simply titled Wolverine by Chris Claremont and Frank Miller. This is any Wolverine fan, any X-Men fan knows it just as the Wolverine miniseries, because this set the stage for everything that people know today about Logan. If you watch the animated series, you can think this. If you watch the movies, you can think this. If you've read the modern comics, you can think this. This is the Wolverine Bible. This is this four-issue miniseries. Four issues, by the way, folks. Not five, not six, not more like some of these stories we're dealing with. In four issues, this tells you, and really in one issue, this tells you everything you ever need to know about Wolverine. And I think one of the reasons that there aren't a lot of what I would consider to be iconic Wolverine solo stories until the modern era is that so many writers kind of ran out of things to say about him, because there's so much in this miniseries that it just encompasses the character in a way that so few stories in comics do. Basically, this came out in 1982, and it was a true collaboration between Claremont and Miller. And what I mean by that is Miller is listed as the artist. Claremont is listed as the writer. But if you read the backstory of this, and indeed if you read the actual book itself, there's no way that this was just a Chris Claremont joint from a writing perspective, because it reads like a Frank Miller book mixed with Chris Claremont. And in fact, in the collected edition, there are a few issues of X-Men packaged in with it that show the continuing romance and engagement ceremonies and wedding and whatnot between Wolverine and Mariko, which serves as the backstory of the entire series. And you can tell the change in when it switches from the Wolverine miniseries to the X-Men issues in the way it's written, the way it reads, because this miniseries was far ahead of its time in its internal monologue for Wolverine. This is one of the first uses I can find in comics, mainstream comics, of the narrative boxes from the first person perspective that is now common in the industry. You know, you can't pick up a superhero book now, for the most part, that doesn't have those narration boxes of the inner monologue. But back in the day, that was thought bubbles, and the narration boxes were from an omniscient narrator usually. So that made it unique. We get to see, and that's a very Frank Miller thing to do, to kind of have that grisly inner monologue where Wolverine is kind of telling his own story as it progresses. It gives us the voice of Wolverine that we're so used to. And yes, that it existed in the X-Men comics. But as Tim and Todd had kind of touched on in their podcast, talking about the X-Men comics from Claremont and Byrne, Wolverine in many ways was kind of a one-dimensional character that was just starting to get these little edges to him here and there that were showing there was more than meets the eye. This was the first time we got the Ronin Wolverine, the idea that Logan is a samurai without a master, that he's a man at war with himself, that his every inclination he has is to turn into this savage feral beast. And yet underneath that savage feral beast, there's this noble samurai that is waiting inside that is constantly battling with that beast. And so Wolverine is very much, unlike the Punisher, Wolverine is a character who is very much in flux in terms of who he is, trying to find himself. And this is a story that shows this badass character, as lame as this sounds, trying to find himself, trying to find his place in the world, and trying to prove himself to the woman he loves, while trying to navigate, oh, by the way, as if this is just some existential, you know, psychological examination. No, he's also trying to make his way through the seedy Tokyo underworld, dealing with literal ninjas around every corner, and corrupt mutants, corrupt Yakuza members, the incredibly interesting and complex character Yukio, who makes her first appearances here. It's just an incredible story. To me, the best Marvel story of all time, because I can think of no other book that I honestly could hand to anybody right now. And I think even after all of these years, we're talking about 1982, I could hand this book to anybody, whether they're a comic book fan or not. And I believe if they took the time to read it, they would come out of it a fan of this character. It's for people like me that are Wolverine fans, like I said, this is the Wolverine Bible. Read it, own it, add it to your collection. It is worth the hype. It is everything that it has been said to be. And for me, it is my favorite Chris Claremont work and among my favorite Frank Miller works.
That's outstanding, sir. You know, I have to kind of take a demerit off of my fan card, I suppose, because I still haven't read that story, but it is certainly on my to-do list. And again, I know you wanted to save the discussion for covers later on, but you want to talk about an iconic cover. I would wager that cover to the first issue of that miniseries
yep.
is probably still, if not the most iconic Wolverine image of all time, among the top three or four.
Yep, that one with the claws and the come-here finger, you know, extended forward with his unmasked face on front of it. Yep. Absolutely. The Frank Miller cover. And the inker on that one was Joe Rubinstein, actually, who would go on to pencil several great comics and also, you know, a hell of an inker in his own right.
Well, you know, for me, my number one story, and I know that this won't come as a surprise to Greg, but my number one story I got to take it all the way back to the beginning. And not necessarily to the beginnings of the Marvel Universe, but to the beginnings of my comics, you know, my comics fandom. And really, the beginnings of what would wind up being, in my opinion, the greatest alternate imprint or alternate universe in comics history, and that was the beginnings of Marvel's Ultimate Universe. So for me, I'm going with the Ultimate Spider-Man run that's pulled straight from the first graphic novel I ever owned, and that was the first hardcover of Ultimate Spider-Man. Now, I know, Greg, you've given me a hard time here. Technically, Power and Responsibility and Learning Curve, the first two story arcs of Ultimate Spider-Man, are two separate stories, but I literally have never encountered them that way. I've always only ever encountered them in one hardback together, and that is the way I have to keep them. So for me, it's Ultimate Spider-Man issues 1 through 13. This is the retelling of the origin story of the Ultimate Spider-Man, the updated version of the classic Peter Parker story that we all know and love, bringing him into modern times, modernizing certain parts of his mythos, you know, such as his role at the Daily Bugle, his interactions with various other characters. Aunt May, most notably, is no longer approximately 174. She's more like something like 48 or 50. So that's a welcome change. It doesn't appear as if she's going to wither away and die at any given point.
Dust in her hooch.
Uncle Ben is reimagined as less of an old man who loves wheat cakes and more of like an aging hippie who doesn't really know how to cope with modern times and the way things have changed.
I just heard on the radio today, Nick, that song. He's an old hippie.
Yep, that's a good song.
Yep.
Mary Jane is reimagined as you know, while still attractive, much more of a true girl next door as opposed to a supermodel who happens to, for some reason, have the hots for Peter Parker. Just the entire mythos has kind of been reimagined, and for me, from issue one, it just worked. I know a lot of people still to this day view the Ultimate Universe as a failed gimmick or whatnot, but I can tell you there, from my own perspective and for a lot of people, it was successful at doing what it sought to do, and that was providing an easy entry point into comics for a generation. You know, it still holds the distinction of being the longest continuous run for one creative duo in the modern era. Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley did 110 issues, and they laid the groundwork for those 110 issues right here in the opening 13.
In full disclosure, those first six were co-written, I think, by Bill Gemas, who was the Marvel editor-in-chief at that time, I believe, or Marvel president, something like that.
Yes, Bill Gemas, who was essentially he was really the guy who came up with the conceit of the Ultimate Universe and knew that he wanted to do something like that and kind of then turned it over to Bendis and Miller to flesh it out. But you got to remember, before he wrote the Ultimates, Bendis or Miller launched the second ongoing Ultimate Universe title because he wrote the first story arc of Ultimate X-Men before handing it off to another writer. So, Gemas had come up with that that conceit, and so yes, he technically does co-write the first seven issues, which is what comprises the Power and Responsibility storyline that kind of tells the story of, you know, the classic Spider-Man origin. Peter gets his powers. He seeks to use them for personal gain. That winds up biting him in the ass resulting in the death of Uncle Ben, and it all leads to a big confrontation between Peter and Norman Osborn, who, in an attempt to recreate the accident that gave Spider-Man his powers, injects himself with the Oz formula, and you wind up getting a very different version of the Green Goblin, I will allow you, but one that's a bit more of a physical presence than the mainstream version. But the reason why I feel like these two stories were conjoined together in this hardcover and why they kind of read very well as one story is the story is very much about Peter trying to work through that classic teenage emotion of loneliness. Like, every teenager, regardless of how supportive their family is or how good they really have it, every teenager at some point in their life has felt miserable and felt like they're the only person on the planet who who knows pain or knows, you know, any kind of suffering. And Peter...
Fat. they know pain.
Pain. Yeah, there you go. But Peter kind of has to work through that, and you see him dealing with the depression of the death of his uncle, pouring that into his adventures as Spider-Man, and at the same time, in his personal life, kind of pushing people away, and it all culminates with him finally finding something of a kindred spirit as he rejects the isolation of keeping the Spider-Man secret, he rejects the isolation of coping with his uncle's death by himself, by revealing his identity as Spider-Man to Mary Jane, and the book ends with, you know, their version of the first kiss between the two characters, and it shows you that Peter has finally found something, something that truly makes him happy in the world. And so it's just a great little emotional story. But along the way, not just the introduction of the Ultimate Green Goblin, you also get the introduction of the Ultimate Kingpin, who would provide some of the most entertaining exchanges between Spider-Man and a villain that would happen over the course of the entire 150 issues. Every time Peter and Wilson Fisk sit down to have any kind of interaction, it's pure comedy.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
It is Bendis at his best, and it continues every time the character makes an appearance, you know, in subsequent story arcs. But this kind of, you know, lays the foundation for that. And so, you know, while I was tempted to list the entire 150 as one big story, I have to give the nod here at number one to the story that laid the foundation for everything that would come since, and the story that really, in a lot of ways, is largely responsible for the person I am today. You know, the role that comics plays in my life. So, for all those reasons, I gotta go with Ultimate Spider-Man 1-13 as the greatest Marvel story of all time, in my opinion.
Yes, it's really good. No doubt, it's really good. The Kingpin interactions are awesome. Also, the very bold choice to have the fight between Spider-Man and Green Goblin resolved by Norman and Peter realizing they both share an Uncle Ben. So, very bold choice by Mr. Ben.
Now, see, I thought, yeah, that's right, because Norman had an Uncle Bernard, who he just called Ben for short, I think.
That's right. That's right. Bernard Ben Bernardson. Very good.
Bernard, Michael Bernard, and Jack Bernard.
Jack Bernard, yes. So, we come to the end of another countdown, folks. There you have it. Our top five Marvel stories of all the times. Just to do a quick recap, at number five, I had Fatal Attractions. At number four, I had The Punisher, Welcome Back, Frank. At number three, I had Thor, The God Butcher. At number two, I had The Infinity Gauntlet. And at number one, I had Wolverine. Nick?
At number five, I had The Ultimates, Volumes 1 and 2. At number four, I had Ultimate Spider-Man, Death of a Goblin. At number three, I had Thor, The Surtur Saga. At number two, I had Thor, God of Thunder, The God Butcher, and God Bomb. And at number one, I had Ultimate Spider-Man, and I believe the two individual story arcs that they collected into that one hardcover were called Power and Responsibility and Learning Curve, respectively. But I only know them as Ultimate Spider-Man Hardcover Volume 1. So there you go.
Very good. And to touch on something we were talking about earlier, iconic covers and the importance of an iconic cover. As I look at my list, I look at Fatal Attractions, and what I remember most, even over the interiors, were those covers with the holograms on them. When I look at Thor the God Butcher, and I remember these incredible painted covers, or seemingly painted covers, by Esad Ribic. When I think of the Infinity Gauntlet, I think of that cover, that iconic cover of Thanos with the Infinity Gauntlet clad fist in front of him, you know, and the light shining off of the gems. And, yep, of course, with Wolverine, I think of that iconic cover of the gesturing finger. And I'm not sure where I'm going with all this, except to say that I think our lists are at least somewhat rooted in our personal biases of what characters we prefer. And I think part of the characters that we prefer go back to the characters that drew us in. And let's face it, what draws you in the first time you walk in a comic shop is the cover. And I think maybe there's something to that one of the things that kind of gets underappreciated and lost is how important that cover can be not just – obviously, it doesn't affect the interior story and how great it is, but I think that it can affect how memorable a story is, if that makes sense, because your mind associates these images with where you were when you read it and what effect it had on your life and also what it means to the character that it revolves around. So I think the covers really tell a story about how great these books are in and of themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, while there may be moments from each of these stories that stick in our minds, it's these covers that leave such an indelible mark. I mean, that cover to Ultimate Spider-Man number one is still probably the first image that pops in my head when I think of Spider-Man, just because of the impact it had on me throughout my life and how many times I've revisited that. Various other things. I mean, that issue to Thor God of Thunder number one, that cover is, I have that on my desk or on my cube at work because it's quickly become one of the, you know, most iconic Thor covers of all time. So certainly I would agree with you that a cover is an often underrated aspect of how iconic or how well a story will be remembered.
And with that being said, folks, we're almost ready to take our break here. And when we come back on the other side, we'll have Read and Watching. We'll have the rundown. Stay with us.
Oh, there it is. We didn't have one last week. You thought it was over. Is it over? No, not yet.
30 men will enter my ass. In any event, folks, we have a breaking news alert here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. No, no, no. Much to your chagrin, I'm sure it's not yet another version of Jim Ross's My Ass. But we do have an alert, and it says here, well, what do you know? Ho-Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment. Oh, thank goodness for that, right, Nick?
Absolutely. Thank the maker, as C-3PO once said.
Be sure to tune in to our show because it may not happen every week. We don't know. We have no control over when these alerts come in. As you heard the sound. I mean, sometimes we just get these alerts in the studio and we have to report them to you, the listening audience. So you never know when the Ho-Ho Loon ticker might go off again. But stay tuned, you know, every week just to catch up, I guess, and find out what these alerts have to say. But that being said, folks, enjoy the break. And we'll be back in just a minute.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easy to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Here of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We got your favorite segments here to become your weekly segments. Of course, in a little bit, we'll have Read and Watch and kick off with
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to
right, folks, it's around your weekly look through the news and notes of the comic book world. And we're going to get on the printed page with Marvel Comics and one of the greatest comic book artists of all time, Alex Ross, whose painted imagery is just legendary in the world of comics. You might know him from Kingdom Come. You might know him from Marvel's. He has unveiled a new image, or Marvel has unveiled a new image, teaser image, via social media that was initially shown to comic book retailers, and no information was released except that the caption was Generations and that it will be published in the summer of 2017. The image features generational heroes in Marvel. In other words, you have three different generations of Captain Marvel on the cover. You have two generations of Nova, Richard Rider and Sam Alexander. You have both Steve Rogers and the Falcon as Captain
Sam
America.
Yeah.
Yes, I forgot his name. You have the Hulk and have the totally awesome Hulk.
Peter Parker and Miles Morales.
Miles Morales, yes. Jean Grey and Rachel Grey.
I'm gonna make you a little upset. I believe that's actually Jean Grey and time displaced Jean Grey.
But regular Jean Grey's dead.
Yes, but so are some of these
also
other characters.
So is Wolverine. I see your point.
Yeah, Wolverine, Logan, and Laura Kinney, aka X-23, mm-hmm. as Wolverine. You have the O-Son and Jane Foster Thor. So you have all these various
generational heroes, yes.
Legacy heroes in the Marvel universe,
yeah.
Essentially.
Right, and so we don't know anything else about the image, but Nick, what's your speculation?
My speculation is that this is just going to be some sort of time travel standalone story that's going to feature awesome Alex Ross art. That is my honest belief. My hope, like if I were hoping against hope, is that this is actually the basis for Marvel's latest or most, you know, next big rebranding, and that this image is meant to tease, you know, the return of some of our classic, the more classic versions of our favorite heroes, and as I called for on our, you know, year in review giant size podcast, something of a rebirth approach to the Marvel Universe. Now, again, that's what I want to happen. What I believe is going to happen is some sort of self-contained standalone story.
And see, I'm actually the opposite. I think this is going to be Marvel's version of DC Rebirth. I think this
Fine,
is going
bring
to be
it on.
a realignment of, making all of these characters, in other words, share their mantles at the same time, essentially. And which is going to be kind of interesting because I feel like, rightly or wrongly, my perception of Marvel was always that it was the company that had, you know, everybody had their own defined role, whereas DC was the legacy company. This is going to be kind of interesting to see if this is what it seems like, which would be Marvel embracing having pretty much all of their main characters be legacy characters.
Now, to be fair, current Steve Rogers and Sam Wilson are coexisting already. I believe both versions of Nova are also out there currently. I know for a fact that Carol Danvers and Kamala Khan are both operating simultaneously in the Marvel Universe, Peter Parker and Miles Morales. So for a lot of these characters, the idea of operating alongside their more, iconic and classic counterparts isn't exactly a new one. So, some of these I think it'll be a bit of an adjustment, but others I think it's something that Marvel has already shown they have an ability to do. If they could, while admitting that as a Marvel reader, they could probably be doing it a little bit better.
Right. Now, if it is just a standalone event or standalone miniseries or something, it's got to have Alex Ross interiors. That's kind of the most exciting aspect of this for me.
I mean, it's tough, though, because, I mean, Alex Ross interiors requires an amount of lead time that is...
Oh, sure, yeah.
I would be satisfied just with Alex Ross covers, but, I am more easily pleased when it comes to the Alex Ross. He did covers for Secret Wars last year, and it was awesome. So,
no, I'm sure the covers are going to be wonderful, no doubt. But speaking of Marvel and the printed page, an update actually on a story that we talked about several podcasts back in the rundown. We mentioned Scarlet Spider was going to be getting his own ongoing. Ben Reilly, that is, was going to be the Scarlet Spider in his own ongoing. And we also mentioned that he got a rather somewhat unique costume redesign, modernized costume by Mark Bagley. Well, turns out that didn't last too long because Marvel has already announced and released the image that Ben is going back to his original Scarlet Spider costume from the mid-90s, much to my happiness. And they've already redone the cover with him in the original costume. So, or redrawn the cover with him in the original costume. Bagley redrew the originally released cover to the image that with him in the old costume. And Marvel insists that they are not backtracking on the costume, but that it's a story-driven change that will lead Reilly back into the hoodie. Which, again, I would question necessarily calling it a hoodie. But, whether you believe that they're not backtracking or not, I thought the reaction to the costume was pretty good. People just didn't like the hood. Maybe Marvel thought that they just didn't like the costume in general. Or maybe this was always the plan. But I kind of find it hard to believe that they went through the trouble of designing a new costume only for a couple of issues, don't you?
Right. Yeah, I have a hard time believing that as well. And just to be clear, while they re-released the cover to the first issue with the classic costume, the new costume that we saw on the initial cover that was released will be the costume for the first two issues. And apparently the first story arc that I would assume is going to be – will comprise the first trade – will feature at the end of it his return to the classic Scarlet Spider costume.
Right, and ultimately, it's really not that big a deal. I mean, personally,
it really isn't.
I liked the new costume except for the hood, but obviously, I'm happy that he's going back to the old one because that '90s costume is a good one. Like people liked that look. People liked it back then. People like it now. It's iconic. People know it. That's what people think of when they think of Ben Reilly, even though I always think of his really cool Spider-Man suit, but that's another story for another time. So it's exciting, and this is a series that definitely is on my radar, even if I cannot afford to add any comics to pull list.
Yeah, the Mark Bagley art certainly has me interested in it, so I'll probably give it a look for a couple of issues. And, of course, you know, being that it's written by Peter David, a close personal friend of Place to Be Nation and a close personal friend of the podcast, I think we're, you know, morally and legally obligated to give it a look.
Absolutely, and in no way have we ever implied that he was no longer in the plane of existence.
Greg, what's going to happen whenever Peter David finally has a guest appearance from Miles Morales? I feel like the universe will cease to exist, that, like, the causalities will just all collapse in upon each other.
We will finally have created a singularity.
Yes. Yes, we will.
Well, from ground that we were mentioning an update on to, you know, actually, let me go ahead and, before we move on to our last segment of the rundown, let me update folks on another movie franchise. We talked last week about how the new X-Men movie was apparently in development, or planned to be in development, according to the actress who plays Jean Grey. Well, now it is coming out, according to Collider, that Simon Kinberg, who is the executive producer of most of the X-Men films and has written, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, has written the vast majority of the X-Men films, at least in recent years, he is in talks
according to his IMDb resume, Greg, he has either written, produced, or been heavily involved with X-Men The Last Stand, X-Men Days of Future Past, X-Men Apocalypse, Deadpool, Logan, Legion, the current FX television show, and the currently in development New Mutants movie.
So pretty much the showrunner, essentially, of the X-Men film franchise right now.
Alongside Bryan Singer, who we've been told is departing, for the time being anyway.
Right. So the story that we're getting to here is that Simon Kinberg is in talks to write and direct the next X-Men movie. Now, this is noteworthy in that he has no prior directorial experience. He has exclusively been a producer and a writer on these films. So it looks like it's moving forward. The next X-Men sequel is going to happen. And it looks like Simon Kinberg may be the guy that will be helming the ship. As an X-Men fan, I have mixed thoughts on this. I think he's done a good job. I know a lot of people – there's a lot of X-Men fans that don't like the movies at all. I am not one of them. I love the movies. I think they've done, for the most part, a very good job with them, especially since Kinberg came on. I think he kind of righted the ship, at least after The Last Stand.
Yeah, he was involved with The Last Stand, so we can't fully say that. But I stand by the fact that I think Days of Future Past is one of the finest superhero movies, you know, in general. And so he was involved with that. He made that. He helped out with Deadpool.
The Wolverine.
The Wolverine, you know, Logan, which we haven't seen yet, but early buzz says that it's very good. I think my greatest concern was that once Singer walked away, they were going to go with a choice that was going to take the franchise. I'm all for new directions, but you kind of have to get there gradually. You don't really want to just go wildly in a completely opposite direction, a la, you know, Tim Burton to Joel Schumacher. And so I think having someone who will at least be able to maintain a little bit of that stylistic continuity is probably a good choice. Although, you know, having this be his directorial debut does give me some concern.
Right. And we'll just have to, as we always say, we'll just have to stay tuned and see how it all turns out. But let's move on to a section of the show that has become a regular part of the rundown.
Well, before we get to that, Greg, why don't we mention quickly the television news that we talked about?
Yes. You go ahead and tell people that, Nick.
Yeah, sure. So news broke this past week that one of my favorite writers of the 1990s and mid-2000s, Kevin Smith, of the film world, you know, writer-director Kevin Smith of Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, the Viewless Universe, if you will, fame, has been brought on to write, direct, and executive produce a series based on the characters Sam and Twitch from the Image title Spawn. And interestingly enough, this is going to be a Spawn spinoff series not airing on one of the more traditional comic book platforms, but airing on BBC America. So, interesting choices all around, from the idea of relatively obscure characters, Sam and Twitch, getting their own series, to Kevin Smith being chosen to be involved, to BBC America getting into the comic book game. Greg, your thoughts on all this?
You know, I don't know a lot about the Spawn franchise. I don't know a lot about these characters. But Kevin Smith's clearly a fan of comic books in general. So, hey, you know what? More power to him. And hopefully this will be a successful project that can make Spawn a relevant comic book figure again. Because I think it's probably time for that. You know, he was a big deal in the mid-90s, late 90s. And certainly this is a chance to kind of perhaps reawaken a little knowledge of that section of the superhero and comic book world.
Yeah, and I wonder how much, you know, the character of Spawn himself will actually be involved in the series, because Smith's quote says the series is about these big city homicide detectives who face a series of super grisly crimes that are connected to the occult. And again, the series is being pitched not as a Spawn series, but as a Sam and Twitch spinoff series. So I wonder what their take on Spawn and his involvement in the plot of the show is going to be. So I'm interested in that. You would have to think that, you know, BBC America will have a decent budget, but they're going to be a little bit limited in what they can do from a visual effects standpoint. So I wonder if maybe that's why they're not going with a full-on Spawn series.
Yeah, that's a great point, Nick. Great point. But again, we'll just have to see how it turns out. We'll see. We'll see what it all develops into. But let's move on to, as I mentioned a minute ago, we're becoming a recurring factor here, a recurring segment. And that's our weekly look at the somewhat unique situation that is the DC Extended Universe, a.k.a. the DC Cinematic Universe, which they don't call it that for whatever reason.
Because Marvel called it the Cinematic Universe, and you have to be different.
You have to be different. Our first
Why not just call it... Never mind. I was going to say call it the DCFU, but now I get why that wouldn't be the best idea in the world.
Then they'd have to change it to the DC Attitude Adjustment years later.
That would be awesome. Which I know that some people are hoping that the DC Universe will be getting an Attitude Adjustment in Justice League.
Oh, my. Anyway, let's get started. I want to start off with the not bad news, which is...
Is it not bad news?
Well, it's just kind of strange news, I think.
Yeah, it is.
We've been talking for a while now about how the Shazam movie just hasn't had any development past the fact that The Rock's going to be in it and The Rock's going to play the villain, Black Adam. Well, now, according to reports, the Hollywood Report, it looks as if New Line Cinema, which is spearheading the Shazam movie, and is going to apparently be set up separately from the DC, the other DCU films.
Why?
You got me. Maybe this is their first. Like, well, we speculated last episode, Nick, that. Or I speculated that perhaps this might be them dipping their toes in the water if they do need to abandon ship on the – or they feel they need to abandon ship on the DC EU at some point. They could set up a separate rebooted – quote-unquote reboot universe with Shazam as the centerpiece if that takes off. But that's just speculation. It looks like they are eyeing their director that they want to head it up. And it is David F. Sandberg, who is the director of Annabelle 2 and Annabelle, I believe, and pretty much seems to have exclusively a history with horror films, which, for those of you who may have not experienced Shazam before, Captain Marvel, horror is not necessarily the genre you would turn to. Or think to turn to when it comes to that that character. This director, by the way, did not direct Annabelle. He's directing Annabelle 2. He's most well known for directing the movie Lights Out, which was apparently really good, in fairness. Won some awards, was considered the best horror movie, perhaps, of last year. But, again, a horror movie and Shazam don't really seem equitable. Now, it's also been brought up that James Wan was a horror director and is directing Aquaman, and that seems to be going well, hopefully.
And but, perhaps Wan recommended him for the job because apparently they have worked together in producing gigs on Lights Out and the Lights Out sequel that's going to be coming out at some point. So perhaps, since Wan is one of the guy, a few directors, hell, the only director in the DC extended universe that seems to be on fairly safe footing at this point, perhaps he was asked about, you know, young up-and-coming directors that he would like to work with in the DC universe. But I think that's certainly a possibility here.
Yeah, could be. Well, again, until we see a finished product or even any product at all, it'll be hard to judge. I hope they have a script together that's worthwhile, and hopefully he'll be able to add some guidance to the project and make it work. Because man, this really needs to work, and it really
make
needs
it
not
work. Yes, I agree. Yeah,
and it needs to be modular.
It must be modular.
But the most important thing here is it has to be different. They cannot, in my opinion, make a Shazam movie that's done in the aesthetic of Zack Snyder. And I'm not coming at it from a perspective of somebody that hates Zack Snyder.
Nope.
But his aesthetic is completely wrong for Shazam, for Captain Marvel.
You gotta find a little bit of that. I'm trying to think of a good comparison. A little bit of that Steven Spielberg in E.T.
Yes.
That adolescence,
yep.
That certain quality that makes it, you know, that kind of makes it, you know, friendly to all generations, and I mean all generations. You need to be able to take a 4 or 5 year old to this movie and have them be absolutely enthralled while also maintaining to hold the interest of the parent. It is a tough sell. I think Shazam is among the toughest sells of all the planned DC films, but if they can find a way to make it work, I think it has the potential to be possibly one of the bigger crossover hits.
Absolutely. I mean, there's that. You know, Spielberg in the 80s would be the ideal director of a Captain Marvel movie. This is like a character that needs to reach across the age gap that they really haven't even attempted to reach with these last several movies.
Right.
They really didn't try to reach kids with Man of Steel or with Batman v Superman, and certainly with Suicide Squad. So I think they need to have a crossover audience. They need to – it needs to have something in common with Super 8. The J.J. Abrams movie, something along those lines. So childlike adventure, whimsy. And then when you do the Black Adam movie, you can certainly go much, much darker with that. But, yeah, they need to lighten things up and maybe do away with that kind of grayish hue that has the Zack Snyder movies. So interesting. But let's get on to the biggest story of the week in the DC Extended Universe.
Here we go
again.
Remember
how we... Remember how we told you last week that Matt Reeves, the director of the Planet of the Apes movies, the second one and the upcoming third one in the Planet of the Apes series.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes, I think.
Something like that. Yep. And we reported last week right here on the show that he was almost a sure thing to direct the new Batman movie, that talks were ongoing and that he was pretty well connected to the project, looked like it was going to happen. Our bad. As it turns out, Matt Reeves has walked away from the project. This, again, according to the Hollywood Reporter, other outlets as well have confirmed it. A week after entering negotiations to direct the Batman, Matt Reeves has promptly exited the talks. A studio source confirms that the negotiations have broken down. The possibility does exist that talks could resume when heads cool. However, when it's public like this, that makes things a little bit more difficult. So Matt Reeves, the guy that was supposed to be the replacement, by the way, for Ben Affleck, who recently walked away from the director's chair, now he's hitting the bricks. And if the language of once heads cool is to be believed, if you read between the lines, it makes it sound like there was some blow up between Reeves and the studio, which makes me wonder what in the world is the studio doing, and why would they offer, okay, if the problem is with Matt Reeves, why would they have offered him the job in the first place? And if the problem is with the studio, I think it speaks to a lot of our concerns and a lot of our complaints that we've had. This is there. Listen, I'm no Matt Reeves fanboy. I don't know much about the guy. I haven't seen the Planet of the Apes movies except the first one, which he didn't direct. I don't know much about him in general. I wasn't super excited about him directing this in the first place. I thought it was fine, but I wasn't blown away. But the story is, even though they weren't in a contractual a contractual agreement or anything like that, the story, right or wrong, is another guy walks away from a DCEU project. Nick, your thoughts, and I don't want to touch on the other aspect of this story that actually kind of excites me, but let's just talk about the aspect of him walking away from the project. Your thoughts?
I don't know what to think at this point. Again, I'm kind of like you in that I don't think that losing Matt Reeves is really that big of a blow, because I don't know dick about those Apes movies, so no real perspective to speak from on that. But like you said, I mean, it's another public relations hit for Warner Brothers. It's another public relations hit for DC Films, and it just makes you wonder. Like Seth Graham Smith, Rick Famuyiwa, Ben Affleck, and now Matt Reeves. All. That's four guys in the course of one calendar year, Greg, or a little more than a calendar year?
I think it's a little more.
Okay, fine. Yeah. In the course of a year and a half, then, let's say to be safe, four guys who have walked away from DC projects. And no doubt, the Planet of the Apes movies have been successful and generally well-received by the audience and whatnot. So Matt Reeves isn't exactly, you know, some indie filmmaker trying to make it big. But at the same time, there are few jobs in Hollywood that carry as high a profile as that of directing, you know, being the guy in charge of the Batman franchise. So my question is, what is Warner Brothers doing that would drive people away from that opportunity, and that would drive young up and coming filmmakers in the vein of Seth Graham Smith and Rick Famuyiwa away from the DCEU entirely? Like, what exactly are these limitations or restrictions that they're putting on these directors? I want to know what exactly the environment is they're being expected to develop these movies in.
It's a great question, and it's a question worth asking, because at this point, again, I'm not going to apologize for speculating or for assuming bad things about this film studio at this point. They've earned it. They've earned the negative attention. They've earned the negative media. And until they come out with a universally well-regarded film, they're going to keep getting it. And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Nick.
The longer this goes on, with the Batman in particular, the longer they go without a director, my personal opinion, I think the likelihood of Ben Affleck walking away altogether increases.
Agreed.
Why would he stay attached to a project that he has no clue what the artistic vision of it on it's going to be?
I do want to mention one aspect of this story that's near the bottom, and it came as news to me because I hadn't heard about this at all. Prior to Reeves receiving the offer, there were two, according to this Hollywood Reporter article, there were two other directors being floated for the chair, which are different from some of the directors I had read. One was the Don't Breathe director, Fede Alvarez. Again, another horror director, which is interesting that there seems to be this group of horror directors taking over the DC Cinematic Universe. But the other one, which if this were true would make me say, F Matt Reeves, go on about your business, Ridley Scott, of all people, which I had not heard, but a Ridley Scott Batman movie would, for me, be worth whatever troubles led into it, including up to and including Ben Affleck walking away.
Wow. You'd rather have a Ridley Scott Batman than an Affleck Batman, huh?
No. Not directed, but that, you know, the Affleck directing it train has sailed. But would I rather have Ben Affleck star as Batman or Ridley Scott direct Batman?
Good point.
I'd rather have Ridley Scott direct Batman.
Good point. My only concern with Ridley Scott doing it is that I don't know what level of dedication or knowledge he has of the character, and I worry that it could veer a little bit into Tim Burton territory. Not that it would come off as a Tim Burton movie, but it may be more of a Ridley Scott movie than it would be a Batman movie, if that makes any sense.
And my counter to that is that unlike Tim Burton, Ridley Scott really has made a wide variety of great
movies.
That's
a great point.
A wide variety. I mean, I'm looking at his filmography right now, and we'll just go in the 2000s. He's made Gladiator, Hannibal, Black Hawk Down, Matchstick Men, Kingdom of Heaven, American Gangster, the Robin Hood reboot, which I didn't like, but Prometheus, The Counselor, The Martian, and now he's got Alien Covenant coming up. The Martian, totally different from anything he had done before, really.
That's a good point. Read the first few on that list again.
Gladiator, Hannibal, Black Hawk Down.
Black Hawk Down. That was the one I had forgotten that was him, but you're right. It absolutely was. So
honestly, I don't think I ever knew it was him because I saw it when it came out, and I don't think I understood the concept of, you know, the importance of directors back in those days. But right. Yeah, and going back further than that, of course, G.I. Jane, Thelma and Louise, which I didn't know he directed either, Black Rain, which is awesome.
Ridley Scott directed Thelma and Louise?
Yep. Black Rain, which is a great Michael Douglas movie. Legend, the Tom Cruise fantasy epic.
Yeah.
Blade Runner. Alien,
yes.
Yep. I mean, just the guy has a great resume. And yes, he's up there in age, but man, I am for established great directors taking their crack at the superhero genre, whether it works or not.
You know, actually, this is going to be a roundabout story, but on the set of every movie that he directs, Chris Nolan, before they start shooting, has screenings for his entire cast and crew. They're mandatory screenings to kind of show what some of the influences on the story they're going to tell. And so when he got ready to film Batman Begins, the two movies that he screened for his entire cast and crew were Superman the Movie and Alien, interestingly enough, which kind of played into some of those scenes in Batman Begins of Batman silently stalking the, the various henchmen or whatever. And it kind of had that feel, if you remember that initial early trailer where the people were being picked off one by one by this unseen terror. So perhaps there are some sensibilities from some of Ridley Scott's films that would work naturally in a Batman picture.
Yes. So with that being said, folks, unless Nick has anything else for us, I think we're at the end of the rundown.
Yep.
But we, again, will, of course, update you next week on whatever news story is likely to arise in the next 7 days about the DC movie universe. And we'll keep our eyes on that and keep our ears open and try to figure out whatever else is going on in the world of comics and let you know about it. But now, let's get to reading and watching. Take it away, Mr. Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Reading and watching. What you be reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Between me butchering the name Jingleheimer Schmidt and that wonderful jingle, you can already tell it's going to be a wonderful edition of Reading and Watching. Let's get cracking with reading. Let's get this right out of the way, right off the bat. I only read 3 books this week, so you'll get no bottom book from me. Nick, why don't you get things started with your number 3 book of the time period?
Fair enough. At number 3 comes a book that I was not expecting to find its way into my top 3, but I'm going to go with Batwoman Rebirth number 1. This is co-written by Marguerite Bennett and James Tynion IV with art from Steve Epting, and it was outstanding, man. Like, as someone who has never read a standalone Batwoman book in his life, this did a perfect job of really encapsulating everything that distinguishes the character from Batman. You get all the formative moments of her life in one neat little package. You get outstanding art from Steve Epting throughout. I mean, absolutely breathtaking at times. And I just absolutely loved everything about this. Marguerite Bennett really seems to have a real handle on the interior monologue of this character and what sets her apart from the other characters in the Bat family. And also, like, it had little images of her past that I wasn't even aware of stuff that apparently happened in her previous solo series that looks really interesting. It makes me want to go back and read her old solo series. And, of course, teases of what's to come in her new series that's starting. All of this has me really, really excited to see what Marguerite Bennett and James Tynion IV have in store for this character in both the pages of Detective Comics and in her solo title, because it looks like they have huge, huge plans for this character and how she relates to the rest of the Bat family as we go forward. So I was blown away by how much I enjoyed this one. Batwoman Rebirth, number one.
Wow. High praise indeed, Mr. Duke. At my number three book of the time period, that would be Blue Beetle number three by Keith Giffen and Scott Collins. Honestly, there's no way this would have made my top three if I had read more books. I don't think. Not that it's bad, but honestly, it's not great. It's not particularly that good either. It is a completely average comic book in every way. This thing, again, I know I'm behind on it. This is only issue three, but it's going to have to pick up steam in the next few issues in order to stay on my pull, which I hate saying because I love the concept. I love the characters that are involved. And I think that the bright points here are the dialogue is good. There are some genuinely funny moments, but I almost feel like it's just too restrained right now. It's not wacky enough to be that awesome comedy book that you would expect. And it's also not interesting enough from a plot standpoint to be kind of a serious drama. So it's just kind of, right now, it's kind of stuck in limbo as just kind of an average comic book. And normally I would have no problem with that, because there are aspects of this that I like. I like the character designs. I like the dialogue. But with as much money as I'm dropping on comics, and as much of a percentage of my income is taken up by comics, you can't be average and stick around for very long. So that's my number three book of the week.
Absolutely. Moving on to my number two book of the week, I have got Old Man Logan number 18. This is the latest entry in this story that kind of has, as I've said before, this very alien-like feel to it. And this kind of provides a bit of a conclusion to this story. It provides an answer as to why Logan is kind of time-jumping between the Wastelands time period and the current day time period. Has more great interactions between Logan and Puck. Andrea Sorrentino's art continues to just boggle the mind at times with some of the innovation in the layouts. And also has a great moment between Logan and the young version of Jean Grey. They have kind of a tender moment there. And it sets up what I believe is going to be the conceit of the end of Lemire's Old Man Logan run, and kind of what Logan's ultimate goal now is going to be. Revealing that he has a responsibility he feels that he has left unfulfilled, and that he is now seeking a means to actually return to the Wastelands to finish one last, or to fulfill one last promise that he forgot to keep. So, absolutely love this one. I am going to be beyond sad to see this book go, which I believe it will be ending the Lemire run in May.
Yeah, that's certainly not an anticipated thing for longtime fans of that series, of which there are several here on staff at Place to Be Nation. Moving on to my number two book, Action Comics number 969, which continues the Men of Steel storyline. This involves a battle between Superman and the mysterious character Zaid, who is the helper of L'Kal the Godslayer, who is attempting to take out Lex Luthor. And along the way, we actually get a really cool, what I thought was a really interesting backstory for L'Kal the Godslayer, showing his history and kind of why he became what he has become. And it all ties into Darkseid, and I thought that was really cool, tying it into Darkseid and making it clear that the reason that he is passionate about this and the reason that he was willing to do this, even though he was prepared to retire from his job as this interdimensional assassin, is this idea that Lex Luthor is going to inherit Darkseid's throne and become as bad or worse than Darkseid ever was. So it really worked for me. I was a fan of it. I want to talk about the credits here. Dan Jurgens wrote it. Patrick Zercher drew it. Thought it was good.
Outstanding. Glad to hear you're enjoying that story a little bit more than I did. Moving on to my number one book of the week. I actually have The Mighty Thor number 16. This is the latest installment in the Asgard Shi'ar War. Now, you may remember that a previous issue of this storyline found its way onto my bottom spot just because I don't know shit about the Shi'ar, and I found myself completely lost as to who these characters were and what was going on. This issue, however, chooses to largely focus not on the Shi'ar, but what's going on Asgard. You have a fantastic, hilarious scene of Volstagg addressing the Congress of Realms and trying to seek their approval for Asgard to declare war on the Shi'ar Empire in retaliation for kidnapping Thor. And when they signal to him that they are not willing to support such a resolution, he resolves to filibuster the Congress until they agree to go along with it. And he filibusters by telling them of all his wonderful exploits, and all of which begin with, and then I followed that adventure with a wonderful meal of, and he literally lists like an entire page of all these things that he eats during his filibuster. And it's just outstanding to see the exasperation from all the other citizens of the realms as to Volstagg's behavior. But you also get an outstanding little moment from Lady Sif as she basically confronts the character of Kull, the serpent, the brother of Odin, who is serving in his stead while Odin is tending to Freya's injuries. And she pretty much calls him out on all his bullshit and accuses him of being spineless and actually goads him into declaring war on the Shi'ar. And so it's a great little moment for Sif, who hasn't really had a ton of great moments in recent memory. But also, the bit that does have to do with the Shi'ar Empire, they kind of tone back some of the more ridiculous aspects of it, and they kind of just lean into what makes Thor, this version of Thor, the Jane Foster Thor, a great character. And also you get a cool little cameo from Shadrach of Omnipotent City, the god of daffodils and documentation, who has been brought over to officiate the god challenge as the Shi'ar gods are challenging Thor to a competition of some sort. So it's an interesting little book, and because it leans into some of those really just off-the-wall Asgardian aspects of the Thor mythos, that's why it finds its way into my number one spot.
Very good. At any point during Volstagg's filibustering, does he end any of his statements with, if you will?
No, there's a lot of these and thines, though. Which, man, that would have been great casting if that could have happened at some point, having Dusty Rhodes play Volstagg.
Oh, that would have been wonderful. Let me talk to you for a minute about what's been going on in Ragnarok, if you will. That would have been wonderful. But on to my number one book of the week, and that would be Action Comics 970, which is fourth part of the Men of Steel storyline, The Trial of Lex Luthor. This actually is pretty funny, because the actual trial of Lex Luthor lasts all of one panel. This was an enjoyable book, though. I really liked the backstory here. Superman kind of dealing with his own biases against Lex Luthor and being called out on that by Lacall and by Zaid as he sees the potential future that Lex could bring about. And actually, I apologize. This is actually the issue where you get the backstory on Lacall. The previous issue, you see his wife and child, but you're not really sure what became of them. Although you kind of can figure out that they got, you know, killed at some point, but you don't really find out how until here. And this is actually the issue that gives you all that backstory with Darkseid and why Lacall is so personally invested in making sure that Lex Luthor is put down. And there's a lot of great philosophical questions asked, similar to what you've seen, like Minority Report or something like that. And Lex Luthor, even when he's supposedly innocent, can't help but be sneaky, and he gets caught. So that's pretty cool. And it also has a great last panel that's reminiscent of some of the classic, you know, Bronze Age, Silver Age Superman stories that ends with a shocking statement from Superman that's clearly not going to lead where, you know, where it seems like it's going to. But I enjoyed this issue a lot. You know, maybe not a great issue per se, but a really good one and the best one that I read this past week.
Absolutely. So being that you don't have a bottom book of the week, I suppose I'll go ahead and give mine. And this one is a little bit of a surprise because this is a book that I have been enjoying for a little while. But every once in a while, it seems that Tom King just turns in kind of a Batman issue that sits wrong with me. And so I'm going to go with Batman number 17 as my bottom book of the week, largely because of one decision that he has Bruce make that I know is going to piss you off, Greg, and it really sat wrong with me, how he chooses to handle his allies' involvement in this conflict with Bane. I don't really want to say much more, but pretty much for that one little moment in and of itself, and also the seeming ease with which Catwoman is taken off the board, just kind of a lot of stuff here that I didn't really dig. Although it does feature the long-awaited returns of Bird, Trog, and Zombie, so that should make you happy.
Yes, I am very much looking forward to their return, although now I'm kind of dreading the issue after what you just said about it.
Yeah. So, anyway, moving on to my quick hits, and I'll try to make these as quick as I possibly can. Green Arrow number 17 brings a fantastic conclusion to the Emerald Outlaw storyline. Amico's return to the book really provided it with a shot in the arm, and Ben Percy is continuing to kill it on this title. Spider-Man number 13, the third installment of the Sitting in a Tree crossover between Miles and Spider-Gwen. Very good read, largely dialogue-focused, which is what Bendis does best. Trinity number 6, wrapping up Francis Manapul's initial run on the title. Much better than issue 5, made a lot more sense, and each character kind of gets a moment to shine. Super Sons number 1, enjoyed it. Felt a bit rushed to me, a lot going on in this issue, but still enjoyed it. The dynamic between Damian and John Kent is fun to read. Green Lantern 17, big step up from Green Lantern 16. Feels like Sam Humphries just all of a sudden learned how to write Batman after kind of not really knowing what to do with the character in issue 16, so enjoyed the hell out of this one. Aquaman 17, the first part of the Warhead storyline, enjoyed this one. Not as good as some of the other Aquaman issues in recent memory, but still a solid read. And finally, a little Superman one-shot, Superman number 17, a Dark Harvest storyline. Weird story that's pretty much all about John, but it's kind of interesting that they do something of a horror concept in the Superman comic that was moderately successful, so a decent read here.
Did you read Super Sons?
I did. I just mentioned it.
Oh, yes. I must have missed it. Yes. Some technical issues, ladies and gentlemen. Well, is that the end of your reading?
The end of my quick hits, yes.
Well, let's get on to the watching aspect of reading and watching. Ladies and gentlemen, last week, for some reason, they decided to take off Valentine's Day from The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow. So there was no Flash, no Legends last week. But there was a new episode of Supergirl. There was a new episode of Arrow, and of course, there was a new episode of AMC's The Walking Dead. In addition, I also caught up on Legion on FX. I watched the first two episodes, thanks to the magic of my DVR, and I will offer my thoughts on that. But let's start off on Monday with Supergirl on CW. This felt like a big-time bounce-back episode.
Loved this episode. Yep, I loved it, man. I thought it was probably the best episode of the season to this point. It has taken the character of Lena Luthor and made her ultimately fascinating. I mean, I genuinely have no idea where they are going with the character at this point, which is interesting because so often with a Luthor character, you just assume that okay, they're going to put on a bright and happy face, but really have nefarious intentions behind the scenes. And at this point, I have no idea what her intentions are, what her motivations are, or what her ultimate goal is. I don't know if she's being altruistic in her friendship with Kara and Supergirl, or if she is seeking to manipulate essentially everyone in National City for some grand purpose that we haven't really seen yet. So, I loved the hell out of this episode. Almost every aspect. Even, I will say, even the James Olsen stuff wasn't as annoying as it normally is.
Yes, although I will say this, because I agree with everything you said. Man alive, was James Olsen acting like a tool during this episode, basically convicting Lena based on her last name.
Yes.
From the get-go.
But, you know, I kind of could live with that, because this version of the character is one that we've been told has had that prior association with Superman and has lived this whole other part of his life in Metropolis. And so he has been there firsthand to see how how Lex turned from seemingly a friend into Clark's biggest enemy. And so I get his natural distrust of Lena Luthor. It made sense to me. It didn't ring hollow for me at all.
I would agree with that, for the most part, but it still made me dislike his character more, I'll put it that way, because I thought, man alive, like, literally you're telling her that, well, she's just a Luthor. She can't be trusted. And, you know, that's kind of faulty logic. Granted, Lex had proven that, but that doesn't mean that he's a sister. So I get it. I think it made his character realistic, but it still increased my enmity towards him, if that makes sense. But still, awesome episode. I completely agree with you. I think it did wonders to refocus, and again, Lena Luthor has become an amazing character out of left field this season. I enjoyed the interaction between all of our main characters, including the James conflict with Kara. I thought Kara was better in this episode. I thought she was back to being the Kara that I recognize. I love that she and Mon-El seem like they're finally going to try and move forward. Big fan of this episode. Got off to a great start.
Although, I, as you pointed out on Twitter, they needed to do something about the 1995 Mortal Kombat Kano version of Cyborg Superman they've gone with, because that special effect on his face is, it could use some work. It literally looks like they took the Kano, face piece from Mortal Kombat and just pasted it on his face.
Yeah, if people want, and they can't find it on my Twitter page, I can repost that image in the comment section on our Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics, where you should all join, by the way. And I can repost that image, because it was atrocious.
You can literally see the separation between
the
metal plate and his face. Like, there was a gap between them, so it was...
Yes, and if the idea is that it's supposed to be his endoskeleton now or whatever, just terrible. Just inexcusably terrible. So they gotta clean that up.
Oh, and how cool was it to see the power suit? Lex's power suit in the vault there in the episode.
Oh, yes. Very cool. Very cool.
And we actually got our first glimpse of Lex on the show, as we saw young Lex.
As a young child, yeah.
And flashback scene. So,
And an unexpectedly bald version of Lionel Luthor. I wasn't expecting that, given that on Smallville, Lionel had such a rich head of hair. But yes, very good. Very good episode all around.
Yeah, loved it.
Now let's move over to Wednesday night for a very special episode of Arrow. I say that in jest, but it really was a very special episode of Arrow, in that this was an episode that was, for the first time that I can remember ever on Arrow, was actually attempting to address a social issue.
Yes.
Which in this case was gun violence.
And which, we should point out, of all the characters in comics that you could tackle a social issue with, I would argue Green Arrow is one of those that had the longest and richest tradition in handling these sorts of things. I mean, most of his iconic stories were very socially driven. So I think there's a valid argument to be made. They should have been doing social issues, or not overloading the show with social issues, but I think it's a little weird that it took them 5 seasons to work up to really doing a socially focused episode.
Very true. I think part of it is that their version of Oliver is so Mike Grell influenced, and Grell's run was less social justice-y than I think the Denny O'Neill version was.
But Grell's run still had influences of that, especially when it pertained to the character of Black Canary. So you still had elements of that in there.
True, true. This episode took on the topic of gun violence, as we mentioned, and through the realm, a pretty interesting way of doing it in that there's no supervillain in this episode. The villain of the episode is, as they point out in the show, literally just a normal guy, right? Just a guy that had some bad stuff happen to him, reacted badly to it, has no abilities, has no training. He's just a guy that goes out and kills people because he does. He decides to do it in the spur of the moment, and he's angry and stricken, and it opens up a conflict within Team Arrow between those who, I don't want to say none of them understand necessarily why he's doing or agree with what he's doing, but he's acting out due to the city's unwillingness to pass a gun ordinance and then his family getting killed after the fact. So you get this divide in Team Arrow between those like John Diggle and I'm trying to remember how the lines were drawn. Diggle and Black Canary, who both and also Wild Dog, who support the concept of the rights of gun ownership, and this guy's just a nut job. And then you've got the other side, which would be Curtis and Detective Lance of all people, Vice Mayor Lance, who argue that things would be better off if guys like this couldn't get a gun, and if there was much tighter gun control restrictions. And they each, and kind of Felicity's kind of, you know, caught in the middle, and everybody makes their points over the course of the episode. And what I thought was really, really well done, because this was an episode that very easily could have veered off into corny, preachy territory, in my opinion, which a lot of television shows certainly have in the past when they try to tackle these issues. And some comics do, too. There's a way to do it, and there's a way not to do it. And what I loved about this is that they did not present one side as having the moral high ground or the intellectual high ground, and the other side as having, as being obviously and clearly wrong in everything they were saying. Now, the viewer's personal opinions are going to shape how they view this episode, obviously, and who they agreed with, etc. But what I love about this, and what I think is the ultimate best way of presenting something like this, is when you do give both sides an intelligent argument, in other words. And I feel like they did that here. They didn't attempt to solve the world's problems, but they did give us a character in Oliver Queen that you can't help but wish that our real-life politicians were more like Stephen Amell's Oliver Queen, who, and that's just talking about that aspect of it, Nick, and I'm going to let you talk about that as well, but I also wanted to, while I'm thinking about it, talk about how absolutely phenomenal Amell was in this episode.
Yeah, Amell killed it. He was great.
Tremendous. So, Nick, your thoughts on this episode of Arrow? I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well, and I mean, you pretty much summed up everything about the episode, and I agree with, all your thoughts, but I want to call out one little exchange, and it's the foundation of the philosophical divide, really, throughout the issue, or throughout the episode, is being, they're using mainly Curtis and Renee, aka Wild Dog, as the two representatives for the opposing viewpoints, and they kind of go back and forth with each other a few times throughout the episode, and finally, at one point, Felicity is talking to Curtis, and she says something to the effect of, why do you even bother arguing with him about it? Neither of you is going to change your mind, so why don't you just let it go? And, and just let that be that. And Curtis is like, yeah, you're probably right. And then he turns around and goes, something? No, that's not okay. And he's like, we've reached a point in society where we can't even disagree with each other anymore. We used to be able to have a debate, have a conversation, and at the end of the day, still respect each other and find some sort of common ground. And it's gotten to a point where we can't even do that anymore. And maybe that's why our country's in the damn shape it's in. And it was incredibly on the nose. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to deny that it's on the nose. But it was a damn good, bit of commentary from the writers of Arrow on the state of political debate in this country at this point. So I absolutely loved that little bit of dialogue from Curtis.
Yeah, and I also have a pretty important breaking news announcement for people who are regular listeners of the show. I never thought this day would come. I like Wild Dog now.
He's two episodes, Greg. Come on. You can't – two episodes don't erase, you know.
Except they kind of – for me, they kind of do in this case because I think finally they've given me something to his character to explain why he's the way that he is and why he was so obnoxious in the early going. His backstory was excellent in this episode. As great as the rest of the episode was, I found myself wanting to know what happened. And I have to be honest, what happened was not what I expected to happen. I thought that what was going to happen was he and his daughter were going to get attacked and his daughter was going to get killed because he didn't have the gun with him. I did not expect all that stuff to go down at his house. I really enjoyed that. I got to give the kid credit. The actor did a really good job. I didn't think he had that in him, but he was believable.
I enjoyed it as well, but to use an analogy, they dug themselves such a crater-like hole over the first, 10 to 12 episodes of this season that they are even with the Herculean efforts of the last two episodes, they are just now, for me, starting to break even again. Let alone me being able to say anything about enjoying the character.
Fair enough, sir. If they keep on this continued path, I have a feeling he might win you over in the end. Although I also have a feeling he may not make it to the end of the season, but that remains to be seen.
Speaking of may not make it to the end of the season, did they kill off Evelyn Sharp off screen or something? Where the hell has she been?
I don't know. Where's Prometheus been?
Well, Prometheus I can understand because he's kind of operating in the shadows at least, but I figured they would use Evelyn kind of as a proxy, you know, a means of advancing the Prometheus story without having to use Prometheus each and every week, but she's pretty much disappeared since the mid-season finale.
Oh, God, speaking of which, somebody that had disappeared at least in costume for a little while, I've neglected to mention something I talked about, raved about on Facebook, which is whatever they're paying, and I'm apologizing because I'm not looking up his name, whatever they're paying the guy who plays Adrian Chase, it's not enough.
Oh, that guy's awesome. Yep, he's fantastic.
He is adding a level of gravitas to the show that was needed.
It's Harvey Dent, essentially, and I'm perfectly fine with it. It's outstanding.
Yep. The scene at the hospital when Oliver visited him at the hospital to try to talk him into staying there and not going back to the office, that was – I mean, just the subtext that was playing in there between their conversation – was excellent.
And the bravado there, very reminiscent of, again, Harvey Dent in The Dark Knight, that scene where he's like, where the guy pulls the gun on him, he's like, but Your Honor, I'm not done.
Always buy American.
Yep. Yep.
Anyway, so that wraps up The Walking Dead,
that was Arrow, not The Walking Dead.
I'm sorry, Arrow. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's rank the two CW shows for the week.
Sure.
I'll go Arrow 1, Supergirl a very close 2.
Shockingly, I'm going to go Supergirl 1 and Arrow 2, but I love them both.
Yep, both great. Let's move on to Sunday night's edition of AMC's The Walking Dead, which picked up several different loose plot threads, I guess, that were going on. We see Carol again. We get I don't want to spoil this aspect of the show for some people that might not have seen. I feel like a lot of the stuff in this episode isn't going to be a huge spoiler giveaway. I don't want to give away a certain reunion that happens in the episode that is very, very, very powerful. Also we see Rick and his crew as they finally succeed in recruiting somebody to help them in their war against the Saviors, although you have to wonder how reliable this new group of junkyard dwellers will be in the fight. But they go through some hell to get there, and we also see some of the Kingdom's activities, and we see the continuing drift towards, I'm assuming, what's going to be a very bad decision that the character of Richard is going to make very soon.
Yep. Importantly, we get to see more of Jerry, which is really what we need in every episode.
Jerry, who King Ezekiel seems to tolerate. Jerry's
the best, man.
we get a lot of just varied, and we get to see. And gosh, it's hard to talk about this without spoiling too much, but we see Richard in his narrow-minded quest to go after the saviors, which he's correct in, really. But he's starting to go to extremes and to measures that are not appropriate, and trying to drag Daryl with him, and Daryl ain't having none of it. So, really, really, really interesting sequence of events here.
And Nick, we see, you know, I don't want to spoil the reunion or whatever. We see Daryl make, you know, it really illustrates how far the Daryl character has come,
yep,
because he makes one of the most selfless decisions of any character on the show in any season to this point. It is,
yep,
heartbreaking, and it is, some people will say it was the wrong decision, but I understand why the,
yep,
character made the decision that he did and why,
yep,
he chose to stay quiet, essentially. So
agreed. I completely, you know, I didn't engage in the debate, but I could have engaged in the debate with people online about this. And I saw in some groups. I completely understand why Daryl did what he did. You can debate whether it was right or wrong or what have you, and these things always come out in the end. But in his shoes, I don't know that I wouldn't have done the same thing. He may, and it's, but it's a very, very selfless decision, and it's a decision that, like you said, illustrates the growth of that character and why he ranked highly on our lists of the best Walking Dead characters. I thought this episode was excellent. I thought it was very, very good. I thought it progressed the story forward.
I enjoyed pretty much everything involving the kingdom or Daryl and Richard and Morgan and, you know, all those characters. The junkyard stuff was a little drawn out to me, a little weird, and I felt like they were going for cryptic for cryptic's sake at a certain point with this new group of survivors or whatever. So I'm not really sure what their deal is, and I wasn't really, like, intrigued as much as I was annoyed at a certain point with them.
You know, I would tend to agree with that. I think the issue for me is I didn't find them intimidating in the least.
No.
Like, I got the feeling that if they really wanted to, Rick and his, what, five people that were there probably could have taken them all out.
I don't
buy them as a real threat to the saviors.
Yeah, and I get it. They were going, I think the truncated speech patterns and the altered speech patterns, they were going for that they've been damaged in some way by the events that have happened to them, but they kind of just came off as, like, slow and mentally incompetent in some way. Like, they kind of came off as dumb to me, and I don't think that's what they were going for.
I just thought they were auditioning for Watchmen Rorschach, the sequel.
Ah, yes. Ah, yes. Or Simple Jack, the sequel.
Fine like this. But yeah, overall, other than that, I kind of agree. I thought there was some good stuff in there. I thought I don't know what the exact technicalities or the realities of it are, or how they fastened it in such a way, but I did think the visual of the walker with the spikes on him was kind of
Winslow,
cool.
Yes.
But yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. So that was nice and creepy, and there were some good creepy moments. And again, a really good episode. And
it was good to see something go right for the group at a certain,
yes,
point. Like,
you kind of need
that little hope, mm-hmm, spot.
The hope spots. We talked about that earlier. Remember on our year-end podcast, we suggested that perhaps one of the reasons for the declining interest and ratings in The Walking Dead this year, again, still very, very high, but compared to previous seasons, is that they really haven't given the characters any quote-unquote hope spots for quite some time, and they need that. I mean, any wrestling match that's any amount of time, you have to have hope spots for the babyface, even if the heel's going over. And they haven't given that to the heroes very much. So I'm glad that happened. And I don't really know what the consensus is, because I don't read reviews. I just read what people say on Facebook groups and stuff. I've loved this season, and I'm really excited to see where it's going.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to next week's episode, which is going to be apparently very Eugene and Negan heavy. So should be one of the things I love in the episode.
Porter.
Dr. Eugene Porter making his triumphant return.
He's ready. He's ready to use his technical acumen to tell them all about whatever IT problems they're suffering from.
He's a bullet. He can make bullets, Greg. Let's not forget that. A valuable asset in a post-apocalyptic world.
Is it possible he's the Bulleteer, a descendant of the Rocketeer?
That's possible. That's possible. Eventually he'll get a wife and she'll be the Bullet Babe.
Oh, the Bullet Babe, which is not to be confused with the Booty Babe, who was the main squeeze of none other than the Booty Man, Ed Leslie.
And we every week we come back to Ed Leslie, I think.
Ed Leslie. We need to have we need to do that because you know we got like 6 degrees of Reginald Vell Johnson. Well, now we can have 6 degrees of Ed Leslie and just tie everything in pop culture to one of Ed Leslie's gimmicks.
No, you know, Ed Leslie was in some movies, in some Hogan movies, so I feel like you could probably – that's the new game.
Right.
There it is, 6 degrees of Leslie.
He played the Zodiac Man in Mr. Nanny.
Mr. Nanny.
Yeah.
And he was in Mr. Nanny with, let's not forget, Thanatos, who – it must be reminded, Thanatos is Poindexter.
Poindexter is Thanatos.
Oh, down the rabbit hole we go once again.
And while we're at it, you are listening to the longest running
weekly
episodic comic book podcast
in all of
Place to Be Nation. That's right. Hey, and before we end the watching, I wanted to talk for just a minute about Legion on FX.
Yes.
Nick, is this a show you're planning on watching?
You mean you haven't been watching Riverdale?
I made it one episode in, and I feel like I accomplished something doing that.
I am planning on watching Legion at some point, and by at some point, I mean whenever the show probably goes on Netflix and I can binge it, like, next summer or something. So.
Oh, I forgot. I also have watched the first 3 episodes of Powerless.
Oh
gosh! So let me get. Yeah. I know you're not going to watch. I know you're not going to watch Powerless.
No, I am not going to watch Powerless.
Let me start with Legion because this is a more complicated show to discuss in a lot of ways. So watch the first 2 episodes of Legion. As expected, it is a mind trip. I mean, let's get that right out of
the
way.
Trailer sold it as that, essentially.
It is. I would say it's even weirder than the trailers looked.
Really.
Yeah, the first episode in particular, it legitimately took me probably 15 minutes into the episode to even know if what I was seeing was actually happening or not. I was terribly confused for quite a while, but I will say this, interesting. It was not boring by any means. There was shit happening constantly, but it was just like, is it real? Is it fake? Is it part of his imagination? Are we in his imagination? Like, just a lot of weird stuff going on in the episode that was confusing and discombobulating. Interesting, entertaining, funny, pretentious, annoying. Pretty much every good and bad word I can think of, except boring, comes to mind to describe that pilot episode. But there was enough imagery in there, the performances were good enough, and there was a good enough ending that kind of gave you where the dramatic through line of the show was going to be that it hooked me for the next episode. I can't give the pilot a glowing recommendation because I feel like it'll lose as many people as it gets. But the second episode I thought was better, and it's still weird, it's still trippy, I'm still not 100% sure what's going on, but it's entertaining, and I'm glad I watched it, and I'm kind of hooked on it now. I want to see where it's going, and I got a theory about it for folks that have been watching, and I've made this theory clear online, so it's not really a shocker to people that know me well. But if you haven't read my social media accounts, after seeing the first 2 episodes, I don't want to say convinced, but I have a very strong suspicion that this entire show, this entire series, is taking place in Mojo World, or in the Mojoverse, if you will. For those that don't know X-Men, Mojo is a fat, green, spineless creature. Literally spineless, I mean. He has no spine. He has a metal, spider-like exoskeleton that carries him around because his fat weight all over the place. He looks like a giant Jabba the Hutt, basically. He operates in this alternate dimension where he kidnaps people from other dimensions and forces them to compete in survival games that are watched by the people in this universe and this world, and he profits from it, basically. Now, why do I think Mojo – why do I think this show has anything to do with Mojo? Well, my reasoning is primarily that throughout the pilot and into the second episode, the character of David Holler, Legion, tells his psychiatrists and those who are trying to psychoanalyze him that he continues to see the devil with yellow eyes, or the demon with yellow eyes. And when he gets visions of this creature, it's always this fat green head on someone else's body, just this fat floating green head with yellow eyes that looks like Mojo to me. So that's my main reason is that I think he's him. There's also a shot, and I believe it's in the first episode, where in one of his dream scenarios, the view expands, and as it expands out, you see there's moments of his life that are playing out on TV monitors that are scattered all along this mountainside. And anybody that's read a Mojo story knows that he has TV monitors scattered everywhere where he watches all of his victims kind of do battle with one another. Also, the second episode establishes this battle between the, quote, government forces that are trying to rein David in and this other group that are trying to protect David and teach him how to use his mutant powers. I suspect that this is all the machinations of Mojo. So anyway, if any of you out there like that theory, hate that theory, agree with it, disagree with it, let me know. Contact me on Twitter and let me know your thoughts on that. So, yeah, Legion's interesting, Nick. I'll say that much.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a shot at some point. I just know that right now I don't really have a ton of free time, so to speak. So I'm going to
understandable.
I'm going to save that for a binge watch down the road.
Understandable. And speaking
especially
of binge
since,
watch,
I think in March we're going to have Iron Fist. So I got to clear some room on my schedule for that.
And in parts of West Virginia near the Hebner residence,
Iron Fist. Of course.
Iron Fist. That's right.
Yep.
And
again,
and
one can only hope that it will involve Misty Knight getting Arn fisted.
That's right. By Arn Anderson.
Ooh.
Hey, Double A got to get some love, too.
Well, you know, then Misty Knight and Ric Flair would have something in common.
Whoa!
Woo!
Anyway, pardon that. Speaking of binge watching and not Ric Flair being fisted by Arn Anderson, apparently. Let's talk about Powerless. I sat down on the most recent Sunday before recording this podcast and went on Hulu and decided on a whim, based on some recommendations about the third episode, to just watch all three episodes of NBC's Powerless.
May I ask why?
Well, I didn't really have much else to do at that time. I was originally planning on just watch pilot because I was trying to allow the
you could have started Luke Cage.
I was cleaning my apartment, and I was just trying to let the Comet dry in the tub that I was cleaning. And I thought, I'll sit down and watch this little – because it's only 20 minutes, you know, 22 minutes long, something like that, each episode. Not like Luke Cage. It's like an hour long to watch one episode.
True.
So I sat down, and I'd read some good things about the third episode from Todd and Russell and Jennifer here on Place to Be Nation Pop. So I was like, hey, let's give it a shot. So I watched the first episode and hated it. Did not like it at all. Thought maybe one joke was funny on there. In general, just not very strong. Episode 2 autoplayed after that, and I thought it was and much to my surprise, Nick, I ended up enjoying it. I thought I got to the end of the episode. I was like, you know what? I mean, it's still not perfect. There's still things I don't like about it, but the things I don't like about it are more things that I don't like about all modern sitcoms.
Gotcha.
Rather than things that I don't like about this. Stuff like, you know, the every character plays into a certain archetype, you know, and characters that talk a script that doesn't allow scenes to breathe. In other words, every character's got to pipe in at every second with some outlandish thing. Kind of stuff that dates probably back to The Office kind of approach to things. But I will say, overall, much better. And then episode 3, which was based around Atlantis, was really good. Atlantis trying to be a client for this new weapon that this Wayne Tech has developed. or this new, I can't remember if it was a weapon or a protectant or something like that. And representatives of Atlantis come to visit them. And that was funny. There were a lot of good Aquaman jokes in there, not about Aquaman, but just about Atlantis. And, so I will say this for Powerless, it's better than I thought it would be. And it's better than the pilot episode was. There are good little references to classic DC stories. Alan Tudyk's character, who's this Michael Scott-like figure that is the cousin of Bruce Wayne, who's just trying to earn his way to Gotham out of this department, has some good lines about there's a line that's kind of a reference to The Dark Knight where he talks about the days of bandits with masks stealing large rubies are a thing of the past. And then he says, what's in style nowadays is superheroes fight each other for no adequately explained reason, which felt like a pretty funny shot. And there's some fun stuff in there. I think the cast is hit or miss for me, but the good aspects are good. And, you know, I haven't fallen in love with it quite yet like some have, but I think that it's, at the very least, it's watchable, which is much more than I thought just a few episodes ago when we talked about it.
Certainly a ringing endorsement from yours truly, and I will, from you I should say, and I will just take your word for it. How about that?
That works for me, Nick. I'll let you know. I'm planning on probably continuing to watch it on Hulu in the coming weeks. Maybe I may not watch it every week, but I'll probably binge it at times because, again, 20 minute bursts, no problem. So I'll let you know if it continues to improve.
Sure.
And with that, that's all I've been watching. I haven't watched anything else or playing anything else or any of that stuff. Just, I mean, you know us, Nick. We have very busy schedules with work, our home lives, and, of course, the weekly doses of comic books and professional wrestling.
And we are trying to currently prepare our bodies for our annual pilgrimage to WrestleMania, so to speak. So
that's right. We're for that. For those of you who aren't in the know, I do mean to tell tales out of Skule, because I'm going to get to hear the word Skule said like that, Skule, in person when I go see, for the first time in my life, good old JR's one-man show in Orlando, Florida. And also, WrestleMania happens.
And it will represent something of a Place to Be Pop, meetup of sorts, as it will be the first time in recorded history that myself, Greg, Russell Sellers, and Todd Weber will be in the same room at one time.
That's right. We are staying together in a timeshare in Orlando, and we're gonna do it right. We're having a WrestleFest weekend, and I'm sure comics will be discussed. We may, and I don't know, we haven't determined the details of this. I hesitate to even say it. There is a small chance, given all the wrestling shows we're trying to fit into that weekend, and we got a ton, folks, but there's a small chance we may try to record a podcast
of some
together.
Sort. Yeah, we don't really have a fully fleshed out idea for that, but it's being talked about.
This is all contingent on any of us surviving the trip, too.
Right, of course.
So, you know, that's another story for another time. But
and for anybody out there in the Place to Be Nation listening area who may be making the pilgrimage to Orlando as well, we will be having an official Place to Be Nation pre-WrestleMania tailgate party. So if you would like to attend that, you can hit up myself or JT Rosero on Facebook for the details. We will be glad to have any and all fans of any of the programs on Place to Be Nation or Place to Be Nation Pop come out and join us. The one we had last year was a lot of fun. I am promising everyone that I will not be having nearly as much fun as I did last year.
and also, while you're mentioning that, Nick, if you're a fan of our show, if you're a listener of our show, come by and say hello in Orlando. You know, you can come to the tailgate and drop by and say hello, drop us a line.
Yep.
We'll be at the Evolve and WWN shows on Friday night.
All day on Friday,
all
actually.
Day Friday.
We'll be there from about noon until 2 a.m. or so.
Until 2 a.m., yes. We're doing Chikara, Evolve Progress, Kaiju, Big Battle, of course, which we always look forward to.
Yep.
On Saturday, we'll be at the JR show at 2 o'clock. We'll be at NXT that night.
Yep.
And then on Sunday, of course, we'll be at the big one. We'll be at WrestleMania. So stop by and drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook if you want to find us. And stop by and say hello. We'd love to talk to a listener.
Absolutely.
With that being said, we do want to leave you with our contact information, of course. Twitter, I am at gphillips8652. That is at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87, nickduke87. We would love you to join our Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics. Very simple. Just go to your Facebook search bar, type in Place to Be Nation Comics, pull us up, join, and engage in our discussions. You can email us, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. And if you'd like, you can probably find our addresses somewhere and send us a telegram. You know, we're open to feedback of all kinds.
Yep.
And, you know, just send us a smoke signal.
AOL literally about to make that joke, so good job.
AOL at Messenger. I have an AIM account from back in the day, Lash Rules, from my Lash LaRue fandom. Unfortunately, that name has been taken in other platforms, and I can't use it. But that such is the popularity of the Raging Cajun.
Or Bobby Lashley.
Oh, do we love Bobby?
No.
Bath turd. In any event, that pretty much wraps it up. Nick, what do we have coming up in the next few weeks for our loyal listeners?
Well, this month, this episode, I should say, brings an official conclusion to Love Month, as next month we will be moving into the month of March, and we will be, in honor of the release of the film Logan, we will be delivering to you an entire month of Wolverine-themed shows. We will be kicking that off next week with a very special edition of the Long Book Hunters on the first volume of the Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino Old Man Logan ongoing series. The following week, we'll be coming at you with a full-length, feature-length review of Logan, as Greg and I are both planning on seeing that film opening weekend, and we'll be providing that review to you on the following week's episode. In the third week of the month, we're going to be bringing to you a very special edition of Off the Page, featuring a look at the first solo outing for Wolverine on the big screen as we look back at X-Men Origins Wolverine. And finally, we'll be wrapping up the month with a countdown of our top five X-Men The Animated Series episodes of all time. And we, Greg, perhaps we'll be having special guests for that episode?
Perhaps. That is going to take a little bit of doing on our end. We are looking into it right now. So we're looking into it, and we can't make any promises, but we are going to attempt to make that happen.
Right. And so that's what we got coming up for you in the month of March.
Very good. Well, as always, folks, I'll leave you with a final thought. And that final thought is that when we're out in the wilderness, call me Rooster Cogburn. Join us next week, folks.
Death to America and butter sauce. Don't boil me. I'm still alive. Iraq lobster. Iraq lobster.